You see, the enemy has always been here. It's your uncle, your aunt, your father, your mother, your brother, your sister, your nephew, your nieces, who belong to the fraternal orders collectively known as the mysteries. The very highest degrees of which, combined together, make up a secret order known as the Illuminati. Their goal is to destroy all existing religions save theirs, all existing governments save theirs, and shackle the mob in a system of eternal oppressive debt chained to a computer for the rest of their life, in a propagandized world to make them believe that they are happy in this system. Now, do you think they're succeeding?
Yes.
Haven't I described to you just now exactly what is going on in the world today? Yes, they're succeeding. They're succeeding because the American people don't understand their enemy. They don't even know what's happening. You don't really understand sometimes what a terrible burden it is to know some of the things that I know and try to wake people up and impart this knowledge to them and find out that they just have walls built in front of them. They want to be slaves. But we're making some chinks in those walls.
This is Bristol. It's Friday, 5 o'clock. Welcome to the COVID Secure, not the BCFM Politics Show, on Friday the 21st of May 2021. Streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft in Bristol and at radioquk.com in Camberley, Surrey. Censorship and self-censorship of life-saving information is sadly the norm in the UK today, thanks to the media owner collaborators with the pharmaceutical industry. So, if you can restream this live or rebroadcast the MP3, 3 or 4 hours of that at the end at some point, do please let us know. And if you're able to do it regularly, we'll credit you here. So I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Avonmouth activist Ian Robinson and also former Lib Dem councillor here on Bristol City Council, Dr. John Rogers. And as ever, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. In the second part, on Palestine, the fourth military assault on civilian Gaza in a decade, Israeli military strategists use the phrase mowing the lawn, a repetitive but necessary chore. The BBC tells us today 250 people have been killed in Palestine and Israel over the last couple of weeks. But how does that break down? Of course, they're not telling us that, are they? Well, they don't like to say is that that's 12 Israelis against 240 Palestinians. And what about the children? 65 Palestinians as against 2 Israeli children. The brave Israeli army are getting good at killing children. Their only hazard now is how they explain this to the press, if the press even asks the difficult questions. Talking of which, the Associated Press and Al Jazeera headquarters is blown up by the Israeli military in Gaza after a warning. So the people were able to get out in time. A shot across the bows that won't be lost on the managers and journalists trying to cover the conflict in the Middle East. And the press coverage of Israel-Palestine is a story in itself. We hear a former Mossad officer, Victor Ostrovsky, explain how it works, how the Israelis make sure those awkward questions don't even get asked. And a Sky report on Israel, the ultranationalists creating secret online groups to organise and foment violence this week. We hear from Sky, of all places. And on Newsweek, they are looking at the CIA's sinister undercover army, 60,000 strong and hiding behind the veil of transnational corporations. Now, in any other era, one would have thought this would be massive news, but no, it's just in Newsweek this week. And also, Cecil Rhodes' Oxford statue is going to stay. Rhodes' notorious will, and Carol Quigley wrote, which Carol Quigley wrote about, and the Alfred Milner Roundtable Group. Now, what is the legacy, though? Of course, the legacy today is much, but most importantly, the Rhodes Scholars. That is also very, very similar to the Yale World Fellows, of which our Mayor Marvin Rees is one. It's just a different side of the Atlantic. So the Americans come here for the Rhodes Scholars, and we go to the States to be Yale World Fellows. And hopefully they end up thinking the same thoughts about taking over the world. So also Bilderberg 2021 always was evasive. Is it on now? because this is the weekend it normally takes place, or is it the 27th to the 30th of May? They've gone underground, or are they just now running the show? The Bilderberg, the final meeting, was in Montreux, at least supposedly, 2 years ago, which just happens to be the site of the 1934 Fascist International Conference. And the super capitalist depopulation agenda, 2,200 reports of reproductive disorders on the VAERS system here in the UK. And as our unofficial voluntary VAERS catches only a fraction, we hear from Peter Koenig. He's writing on global research about this topic. And finally, the conspiracy classics, number 7. Well, it's got to be Princess Diana, her famous interview with Martin Bashir, and a brilliant interview, and we'll be talking about that in a minute more. But first, Mayor Marvin is back, so we'll be talking to John, a former councillor, about that particularly, and also Ian, as an activist in the city, what that means. Plus, the Glenfrome Road evictions. 50 travellers yesterday lost their homes. Who are the so-called owners, Wales and West Utilities, who privatised that site? And why the urgency? Funny, isn't it? Just happens just after the election of a Labour mayor. And the police were asking the council yesterday to give the people somewhere to stay, but there is nowhere for them, so the caravans and vehicles, etc., are now mostly lining Glenfrome Road, but just simply parked up by the side of the road. What a marvellous improvement that is, but the council just washes their hands of the whole affair. They don't seem to be interested in housing anymore, especially not for poor people who can't pay council tax. Vehicles for change are involved in that as well, so we'll be talking about that a bit. Also, the Tory campaign to remove the traveller camps across the UK. Now, this is a concerted campaign. It's just been launched the last few days. So what's happening by Labour in Bristol is actually a Tory policy. And since our doctor is here, John Rogers, we'll be talking about COVID in the first part, looking at the inquest of his mum with Ian Robinson here, and also the UK's cowboy medicines regulator, the MHRA. Got to talk about them. These are the guys that decide whether a vaccine is safe or not. Well, do you remember something called Silimed? It's an industrial silicone breast implant made by TÜV Rheinland, a safe, supposedly, for human use. Well, the MHRA, the regulators, Dr. Evil, left thousands of women in misery. We just heard this week that they're going to get compensation finally, nearly 20 years after this. It's actually 15 years after this affair. John Wilkinson came from a job at EuroMed to do that job, and he was replaced. He replaced the former medical director at the MHRA, the regulators, in 2019. He was brought in 2012 to sort out this previous silicon implant scandal. So we have the various scandals. First of all, the silicon implant scandal. Then the MHRA boss had to resign. Then we had the vaginal mesh and the breast implant mesh scandal. And they had to then resign. So these are the people that we trust to say the vaccines are safe. How long before June Rain, the current boss of the MHRA, is forced to resign? And HART, a new organisation, as far as I can see, called the Health Advisory Recovery Team, and they publish something called COVID-19, an overview of the evidence, a social and medical costs of lockdown. They say that that must never be repeated, and all sorts of other things too. So this is a bunch of about 25 professors and doctors who decided to form their own little group to inform us about the dangers of government policy and the big pharmaceutical industries too. And who's getting an ear bashing? I referred to it a bit later. Of course, it's Martin Bashir. Rewriting history at the Ministry of Truth, they've been doing the last few days. This former interview by a BBC journalist, he gave his reaction to the Martin Bashir report. But did he obtain the 1995 Diana interview by deception? Did the interview traumatise Diana so much that it led to her fear and paranoia, as her son Prince William has said, and contribute to her death? As Diana's brother Earl Spencer says, a septic tank, apparently the BBC is, almost as bad, says the Telegraph, as the Jimmy Savile affair. Or is all this just the latest chapter in Prince Charles's dog whistle PR campaign, smearing his much-loved ex-wife and anyone who supported her? Also, out with Railtrack and in with the Great British Railways. The white paper's out when privatised running costs per mile treble. That was when it was privatised. The nationalised railway took 40 civil servants to oversee. The privatised one took 400 to oversee. The rail subsidies, I've been doing a bit of maths on this, are around about 6.5 billion. And that doesn't even include HS2. So we'll be running through most of that, maybe not all of it, but some of it certainly in the first part. And I'm joined by, first of all, let's have a chat to Dr. John Rogers. Now, Dr. John Rogers, you're a former councillor here. We interviewed you many times when we were on our BCFM programme for 12 years, over at the City Academy and then maybe even two at the Eastern Community Centre, I'm not sure. So first question I have to ask, is this doctor business, is that a medical doctor or is this a PhD or what?
Yeah, it's good to be back, Tony. It's a very different sort of environment to the last one I was in.
Yeah, not so. PRM. It's a little bit more untidy here. It's almost like a squat, this place.
Yeah.
Not quite as much money been spent, on the equipment, I'm afraid. But still, it's quality, not quantity. Or megabucks that counts. Anyway, so what sort of doctor are you?
Yeah, so I'm a medical doctor. I was qualified in 1978 here in Bristol. I was a GP for over 30 years, Southmead Health Centre in Henleys and also in Avonmouth and Shirehampton. I retired what must be nearly 10 years ago now. I was also a city councillor, a Liberal Democrat city councillor from 2005 until I was booted out in 2013. And during the latter part of that time, from about 2009, I was a cabinet member in charge of transport, then adult social care, and then deputy leader of Bristol City Council. And I stood against George Ferguson and Marvin Rees in the 2012 election. So I spent 25 very happy hustings around all areas of Bristol, learning all about those two wonderful people.
So when you say booted out, was that by the Lib Dems or the voters?
It was by the voters. The voters, for some reason, in 2013 were unhappy about that.
Well, I think we know why, don't we? We know why. Would you like to tell us why? Because we know why.
Yes. We had this interesting coalition at national level with the Conservatives, and so we had a coalition formed which actually got the support of 97% of Lib Dems, but we were all very naive about how that would play out. And talking to colleagues in Europe, if you're the minor party in a coalition, everything that goes well, including many of the Lib Dem policies, are claimed by the Conservatives, and anything that goes badly is blamed on the Liberal Democrats. So we had a really torrid time, particularly over, our promises over tuition fees and so on. There was a lot of upsets then.
And, okay. Well, before we get into the medical stuff, what do you make of the re-election of the mayor here and the mayor system generally? You've watched it all unfold.
Yeah, I not a believer in the mayoral system. I wasn't when I stood for election in 2012, and I'd been one of the people campaigning against having a mayor. So it's a bit ironic that you end up sort of standing for the role. But the bottom line is that it places a lot of power and a lot of responsibility in one person's hands, and the challenge of that is actually to not let it go to your head and not let it and make sure that you've got really good, supportive advisors around you that are giving you a broad range of advice about what you should be doing. And unfortunately, both George Ferguson and Marvin Rees, in my opinion, have not used the strength and the skills of many people, both councillors and indeed others in the city, in their approach, and have literally been guided, I think, by Bristol City Council officers in what they're doing. And it's unfortunately that has not been to the benefit of the people of Bristol.
Okay, so who's guiding those officers? I ask you these things because before we had the mayor system, the Lib Dems actually ran the city, didn't they? Didn't you?
Yeah, we did. And we had, lots of robust discussions with officers and lots of things that were done that we fought against what the officers were suggesting. So I guess who's deciding what's happening? It's, I honestly don't know. I don't know. The decisions that are being made, it seems to be in the interests of the council rather than the interests of the people, I think of examples, but the
Yeah. Okay, so, I mean, for example, the scooters is one thing. This is quite controversial. Lots of young people love them. Lots of, I mean, it seems to me to be a way of kind of changing the whole flavour of the city, which is more to do with, you know, sustainable transport of some sort rather than having loads of cars running through the city, local transport, you know, that sort of thing. That's just one thing. But the other, probably the biggest change that we've seen, I think, is the massive increase in the number of big developments going on in the city. That is to say, buildings. Property speculators seem to be getting their way.
Yeah, I mean, the scooters, I mean, transport was one of my main interests when I was in the city, and we couldn't really get anywhere until we became a transport authority, and we still can't as a city. And part of the discussions I had with George Ferguson after I lost the mayoral election was to take on the transport portfolio and introduce transport for Bristol. But it's you know, First Bus is very strong. They basically, they dictate, as far as I can see, they dictate the transport policies. As for the develop, you know, the lot of big developments and so on, and big industry, big business, it's big business. You know, the things like the arena and the decisions there, it seems to be all directed from people outside our city who are making the decisions and not what is best for the people of Bristol.
Yeah, or financial interests within the city as well sometimes. I'm thinking obviously of the merchant venturers, people like this that, you know, the people that own the city, I suppose. But anyway, what about, I'd like to also talk about this eviction yesterday, because, maybe bring you in as well to talk about this, Ian. I mean, we've got the situation with the housing list. When I was first looking at all this, and I was actually part of a consultation and went on then to be on the board of the Community Land Trust, we had between 15 and 17,000 homeless in the city. They now reckon around about 20,000, so it's going up and up. You know, you can't blame this on immigration anymore, because there's much less immigration going on. This is a serious problem, which is seems to be getting worse and worse, and the council's stepping back from, really, it seems to me, having any responsibility for it. And this is very well illustrated yesterday with 50 people who are living in vehicles and caravans in Glenfrome Road, just getting hoofed out on their ear. This is by the private company. It's not the council owning the land, but the police were, well, I wouldn't say begging, but asking the council, saying, look, you know, this eviction is happening. If you don't find anywhere any piece of land for these people, they're just going to be straight back on the street again. And the council don't really seem to mind about that. But anyway, I think housing is something which everybody feels in some way. I noticed recently as well that ITV, both locally and nationally, are doing regular weekly updates on housing conditions around the country, which are getting worse and worse. And we can't really turn a blind eye to this any longer.
Unless you're Marvin Rees, of course. You know, Marvin makes much of Bristol being a city of inclusion, a beacon of hope.
He's got this thing called the One City Plan, hasn't he, which is his own mates, basically, that he picks to go on these various policy boards. But, of course, it's not really one city. It's two cities, a rich and a poor city, and the split is getting bigger and bigger.
Yeah, and to be fair, you know, the Lib Dems can't get away from their role in this, you know, when they were in power in the city. You know, you made the point, Bristol seems to be run for a big business. Under Lib Dems, you let, or you defined a policy of Avonmouth being the industrialised waste processing capital of Europe, you know? And people have suffered ever since and will continue to suffer. We've just had the announcement that we're going to have the world's biggest biogas refueling station for buses and HGVs in Avonmouth, and we've only just recently lost four people.
Right, the previous one exploded. So rather than take a good look at it and say, is this a good idea, they're deciding to double down and make an even bigger one.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure if this is the same site. I think there's maybe another site. I think it's CNG that are developing that site. But, you know, this makes a mockery of Darren Jones with his ring of steel of any further industrialised developments in Avonmouth. You know, that's just all forgotten. The same with Marvin, you know. is the people of Avonmouth will suffer again, and the people in North Bristol will suffer again, because we have a tale of two cities.
Do you want to just answer those questions there, John, about what the Lib Dems did? I think it wasn't it Nick Clegg came, who was the Lib Dem leader as part of the LibCon coalition, and signed some agreement, I believe. I can't even remember what it's called now, but it seemed to me to be, you know, more money. We got a metro mayor, we've got various other things, but how do you answer this accusation about Avonmouth particularly?
Well, I was a GP in Avonmouth for 10 years, so I'm sort of very familiar with the area, and certainly the only development that I'm aware of was associated with the waste plants, which was generating energy from waste.
Incineration.
I can't answer any specific things about what was done then.
So what do you think about, you know, what's happened in Avonmouth? Was there a better way to do things? You're west of the city, you're upwind of us. Anything that happens there basically just floats towards us, doesn't it? And I'm a little bit nervous about this. We're hearing all this stuff about pollution, and we've got to, you know, charge everyone to come in and out of the city in cars and taxis and things and lorries. And yet there seems to be more stuff belching out of smokestacks in Avonmouth and heading this way than ever before.
We're incinerating nearly 2 million tonnes of waste in Avonmouth per annum. And I've said this before, back in 1976, the old municipal incinerator that was in Avonmouth, which is now the waste recycling recentre, had to be closed down and refitted because mollusks over 10.5 kilometres away were found to have elevated levels of lead, PAHs, etc. in their flesh by a Bristol University study, I believe it was, and they traced it back to the Avonmouth incinerator. So wherever you are in Bristol, those 2 million tonnes that are being incinerated, that aren't even counted or measured in the clean air zone, is going 10.5 kilometres in a circle from Avonmouth. So none of you are safe.
What about Hinckley? That's just down the road as well, isn't it?
Yep.
I mean, that's all been, but I was driving down Bridgewater the other day, a massive amount of work going on down there. But anyway, I think on the housing thing, what do you make of the this enormous divide between the homeless, or the increasing numbers of homeless, and it seems to me absolutely 100% clear that although the council is up for building some social housing, it's very, very slow, and when it comes to actually housing the homeless, they've just given up.
Well, they're pushing out into the charity sector, and also into I can't remember the name of the company that was, you know, forcing people into old schools and old factories, etc., to live as sort of slaves to the corporation, which the council was forking out.
Oh, right,
for.
This is inadequate housing, I think,
yeah,
isn't
exactly.
it? And they were saying,
property
well,
guardians.
That's it, yeah. What do you make of that? That's an interesting one, isn't it, John? Putting people into inadequate housing and charging them.
I mean, yeah, it's, again, I don't know any details about that either, but it's... I guess if unfortunately a lot of people are pretty desperate for housing, and therefore they will go along with substandard. I know certainly when I was a councillor, there were people living in very poor conditions in St Paul's and Montpellier, and they literally didn't want to make a fuss because they were worried that they would be evicted if they pointed out the house was or their flat was uninhabitable. They would be out in the street, and so it was sort of, you know, sort of catch 22 really. If you complain, you're out. If you don't complain, you live in appalling conditions.
Anyway, it's terrifically commendable of ITV, or ITN, I suppose it is, that runs it, the news, to do these regular slots on housing, because this often gets forgotten about, where they take the cameras in to show the terrible conditions that people are living in. And often it is local authorities that are supposed to be running these places. But the thing I'd ask you about, Martin Summers, is this whole idea that the Conservative Party is now rolling out a whole campaign. This is the 20th of May in The Guardian, under their Guardian's Roma, Gypsy and Traveller section. The removal of traveller camps has been pledged in Tory Facebook campaigns. Politicians have been accused of using gypsies and travellers as political footballs after local candidates for the May polls placed hostile ads. Pledges to remove unauthorised traveller camps in Britain featured prominently in Tory adverts ahead of the local elections during May, prompting accusations that the party has used gypsies and travellers as political footballs. The Guardian has identified 47 adverts brought by local Conservative candidates since January that promised to oppose pitches. The adverts are placed by about 20 different Facebook pages, etc., and have been seen at least, well, roughly 500,000 times. This is getting towards this idea of a kind of beggar thy neighbour attitude, where we've got a house, we vote Tory. If you don't have a house, tough, and we're going to rub your nose in it.
Well, the reason they'll have done this is because they'll have their own focus groups. And as John will know, I'm not a big fan of a first-past-the-post electoral system, because it means that you focus your targets on swing voters, and they tend to be relatively affluent voters.
But, I mean, these are people who are going to be voting against the travellers.
They'll have had their focus groups, and those focus groups are, what are you concerned about, you potential Tory voters? And there's only a few 100,000 of them in the country.
So the message apparently is seen as a vote winner in rural communities, where nomadic traveller groups sometimes pitch on private land or local open spaces. Well, there's a very good reason for that, and that is because the city council doesn't provide adequate sites. There's one down in Avonmouth, I think, isn't there?
Yeah.
Do you want to just describe the site? I've been down there, but you as a local person.
Oh, it's right next to the motorway, literally a stone's throw from where we launched four people to their deaths. You know, it's not a nice place to live. I wouldn't like to live there.
Sewage works right next to
it. Yeah, exactly. Right next to the largest sewage work in Bristol that handles all of Bristol. And
now I think there's that the incinerator has started up nearby them too.
Yeah, that's just down the road. And literally around the corner from that incinerator is where all the van people that got evicted, not in Glenfroome, but the earlier lot, they got driven off the side of the road. They've all been placed literally within a stone's throw of the new Veolia incinerator.
Yeah, so, I mean, this is quite obviously one of the worst places in the Bristol City Council area to put people. So they're rather, like I say, it's our local authority that's rubbing their noses in it. I smell a little whiff of fascism here, actually, Martin. It's a sort of thing that, you know, is absolutely unnecessary. Of course, you know, some land. Bristol City Council has got more land than any other council. That is to say, it owns more land as a proportion of its area than anywhere in the country, I remember reading a few years ago. So it's not as if the council can't just provide sites for these people. They can, but they just choose not to.
Well, I mean, because of the way the electoral system works, I'll come back to this, though, that many of the people who are travellers...
No, you're a Labour authority here.
Yes.
Right? They could quite easily
still,
do
yes,
that.
Yes, no. Let's just take, for example, if you
so
were
you're
to...
blaming the first-past-the-post system.
I'm not
it.
Just blaming the first-past-the-post system. Just think about people's house prices, Tony. Clutch your pearls. Think about the effect on house prices of allowing travellers in your...
But your core Labour vote are not house owners. They are...
Many
they
of
are
them
now.
Are. Well, many of the swing voters that you need to win...
Your core Labour voters are not house owners. They're mostly renters, you know, private renters, mm-hmm. or else people in housing associations. Or people who live in council
and
houses.
And those people who are at the poorer end are less likely to be hostile to travellers, but they're not the swing voters you need to win elections. And there's the Tories are pretty cynical and ruthless about this.
Isn't this
they know very well that the people who want to vote for them are actually quite hostile to travellers.
Isn't it more simple than that? That these people don't pay council tax, so the council doesn't really... And they probably
don't vote
either.
That's right. Yeah. So in terms of winning elections...
They don't count.
They don't count unless they're made to count through having an overall policy of housing people so that you minimise the amount of people who are travellers, and those who are travellers are given adequate facilities to be travellers. But that is not what our home-owning democracy subsidised by the taxpayer through stamp duty being, for example, extended... You know, the relief from stamp duty being extended. We've got the biggest house price boom in Britain ever. House prices are the highest they've ever been, even though we're just in the middle of a recession caused by COVID, Brexit, the collapse of the banking system, etc. That is absolutely irrational from an economic point of view.
I can't remember where I was. I think it was around Bristol somewhere. Recently saw as a piece of graffiti, just a big in white saying house price and a big arrow saying down, you know.
Yeah, but that's not going to happen at the moment. I mean, what will happen is there will be a crash. And of course, by having these house price booms, which last about 10 to 15 years, and then collapse, That's what's deindustrialised Britain every time this happens.
But I mean, surely deindustrialises Britain any local authority, any administration needs to consider all of its residents as human beings. These people are basically being treated like Untermensch.
Well, I agree with you. There is a definitely a whiff of fascism about this. But it's always been there. It's a part of the very negative politics which has developed in this country over the last 50 years.
Well, let's have a look at the Wales and West Utilities that own this site on Grenfrome Road. I thought I'd do a little bit digging into them. They are, of course, part of the privatisation of gas and electricity that happened under Margaret Thatcher.
Are they not a not-for-profit company? I'm not asking the question.
I'm not sure.
Wales and West Utilities might be a not-for-profit company.
They have massive shareholders, right? So this is the point. They're a for-profit company. You can buy shares in it.
I think Welsh Water is a not-for-profit company, isn't it?
And they're also Wessex Water as well. So it has some interest in the site. So the question here is, what is going on? Who owns the shares in these companies that have been privatised? Because those are they're driving this policy. And I don't really like the idea that a former public body could be treating people this way. Well, they say they're going to be using it anyway as a site for I think a depot or something. But I wouldn't be too surprised if we see a load of houses springing up on there. Is there anything you think we can ask both of you finally, my guests today, what can we do about the whole situation for finding pitches for travellers? Because it seems like the Tory party are hell-bent on stopping it.
Complicated question. We've got plenty of brownfield land around Bristol that could be utilised.
Much of it's council owned as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Quite a lot of these spot plots.
But there's no money in for that. You know, there's no large developers allowed to lay a lot of money if we do that.
Well, I mean, the council could do that in the interim at least, I would have thought. And I mean, if there was any kind of heart or soul in Bristol City Council, that's what would have happened yesterday. They said, yeah, we've got a spare bit of land. It's not being used for the next few years. Why don't you just move there? But, of course, they're not interested. John, how do we sort this out for the travellers?
Yeah, I mean, certainly identifying land and bringing in some of the land, any of the landowners, including the city council, to find accommodation. There were actually travellers, I believe, on the Westmoreland site just across the road from here for a number of years, and they were providing not just had somewhere as a base and somewhere they could live, but they also were providing a useful function in reducing the damage that was being done to the site and also some of the risks that people were taking.
Well, the travellers are effectively like the night watchmen, aren't they? It can be security if you've got a sympathetic landlord, but obviously the city council is not a sympathetic landlord.
Using people's everybody has an intrinsic worth. Everybody has some sort of value to think, and it's a case of identifying what that value can be. As Martin was saying earlier, there are people who just, you know, don't want travellers anywhere near them, and that's obviously the Conservative Party have identified that as being quite a vote winner if they stand against it. But it's this. What bothers me is the way that everything that is discussed is about dividing and saying that you're other, you're different, you're wrong, I'm right, you're wrong, and it feels very divisive.
I mean, it's a two-city plan again, isn't it? You know, I'll go even further and say this: there is a religion out there. I mean, Christianity seems to have mostly gone. There's quite a lot of Muslims around, and other faiths, etc. But there is another religion, and that's money. And people make their decisions, particularly it seems at Bristol City Council, based on looking at people as little units that can produce cash. I can always remember looking at the planning system over the years. You do look at some planning decisions to think, well, if we can tax it, you can do it. That's the only real criteria that seems to be involved in there. And the idea of running a city as if you're running a for-profit company, I find absolutely abhorrent, and that's where we are now. Let's talk a little bit about COVID particularly. Ian has brought in some documents with him today about the sad death of his mother earlier this year. Now, what were you first told about, and maybe you can just take us through the story of what happened to your mum, Ian?
Sure. My mum suffered quite extensively with Alzheimer's and dementia and COPD for the latter half of her life. And in 2019, she was taken into Glenview care home up in Redland for a princely cost of £750 a week, because she was no longer able to take care of herself and all of the measures that we put in around the home with support, etc., just wasn't contained in her behaviour anymore. In December of last year, 2020, obviously through the whole COVID pandemic, we've not really been able to see my mum.
You able to do sort of things like Skype calls and things like that at all?
Sometimes.
I mean, it's not the same, is it? But
No, sometimes, but, you know, there's trouble with people with dementia. They don't know what they're doing half the time, you know, and you know, you're not being able to go and see them and hug them. You got the odd visit where you could go and stand outside the window and that kind of thing. And then later...
Did you get anything from that? Do you think, or did you just feel it was a bit of an insult to keep you the other side of the window?
Well, it all depends if you believe on the measures put in place, which I believe were driven by the insurance companies to basically isolate all of the old people, you know?
Well, that's bizarre, isn't it? Because what we did is we put a lot of sick people back into care homes. A lot
of
people
absolutely.
Went into care homes. And so the idea that you can't go in, but maybe sick people can, is a bit of an insult, really.
Yeah, yeah.
People with COVID even, yeah?
Yeah, well, I was informed in December of last year that my mother was eligible for a COVID shot, and if she took her COVID shot, then obviously some of the restrictions could be relaxed, which I felt was a bit coercive. But, you know, 99.9% of people... Sorry, 99.99% of people, if they do get COVID, recover well. So...
So how old was your mum?
My mother was 74 years old.
Right. So what do you make of that as a measure, John? Because there's a bit of ethics involved there. So they're saying, well, if we jab your mum, maybe you can see her.
I mean, this is a huge topic. As Ian was saying, really, that there's questions about the way we've approached lockdown. So for me... I've been involved in emergency planning, in pandemic planning, both as a GP and as a councillor and as deputy leader of the council. And we looked at scenarios where there was 1% death rate, 5%, 10%, 30% death rate, heaven forbid. You know, it really terrible, you know, bioterrorism or whatever. All those possibilities. And we looked at how we dealt with it. And the idea that you... lock down the entire country and close businesses and tell people that they have to stay in their own homes and not meet anybody and not things, just never crossed, you know, it was never talked about because it was just such a stupid idea.
Well, surely, you know, it's not so stupid if something has got a very high death rate. We need to just make sure that people aren't, you know, breathing each other's air, touching each other, etc., surely.
But only, I mean, the death rate for COVID, when we first heard about it, was 3 or 4%, which is quite a high death rate. I mean, you know, if 1 in 25 of your friends and family were going to die in this. But subsequently, we now know it is 2 or 3 per thousand. So it's a much, much lower death rate than was originally thought.
So that's like 0.2, 0.3%.
0.2, 0.3% is the infection fatality rate. And it's age graduated. So children never die of COVID unless they've got something serious wrong with them. Very, very rare. Whereas people in their 90s, it's maybe 10% death rate from COVID.
And that has to be factored or acknowledged that most of the people that do die have one or more serious comorbidities.
Definitely.
Such as cancer, such as, you know, Alzheimer's, dementia, pneumonia, all of those kind of diseases. So the idea that the death rate is massive is completely wrong and has been misportrayed by the media and our own health authorities, it must be said. You know, I believe that people... should be charged over what they've done to not only the economy but the 3 weeks to flatten the curve or the impact on the NHS is going to cause thousands, if not millions, of early deaths.
Well, look, let me drag you back to the point about coercion, because, you know, this is quite an important point, isn't it? You want to be able to be making the decision based on what is the best health decision, not as to whether you're going to be allowed to see your mum or not, or hug her.
I mean, informed consent is one of the basic principles of medicine. I mean, it's certainly the Hippocratic oath, first do no harm, but it's also about making sure that someone understands the risks and the benefits. And the difficulty with vaccines is we've been told there are no risks and there are amazing benefits.
Well, I don't think we've been quite told that, have we? I mean, I think there's always a risk.
It's safe, the vaccine is safe and effective. That's what the NHS has been saying. I mean, if you look on the NHS website, the first line, if you look up COVID vaccinations on the NHS, is vaccines are safe and effective. It doesn't say mostly safe and pretty effective. It says safe and effective. And those lines are repeated and repeated and repeated in every media interview on the BBC.
So as a doctor and a clinician, would you agree that that is an accurate statement?
I would not. Safe and effective is an overstatement. It's basically, all the time I was a GP, we would, any medication, if I was going to give you any medication, I would say, this has this benefit to you personally. You've got this problem, you've also got this problem, which means that we probably shouldn't give you this. It was always tailored to the person in front of you. Now, for some reason or other, we've got to a state now where we don't apply the risks and the benefits of a experimental vaccine or experimental gene therapy, which is what it is, but an experimental vaccine which is not yet completed clinical trials. And we're not even approaching it in that sort of basic way. Look, these are the benefits, and there are, you know, I'm no anti-vaxxer. I believe that vaccines are worth, and it's quite possible that vaccines are really, COVID vaccines are really beneficial in the elderly or the vulnerable. We've got other things, but to say, you know, I mean, they're now talking about children being vaccinated, you know, when they just have no reason to be vaccinated at all. And the risks of vaccination, including death, we've got well over 1,000 deaths now reported in the UK on the MHRA website. There's been, 10,000 in America, in the VARS database, including young people, 17, 18, 19-year-olds. And I believe there's even been deaths of babies who've been breastfed by mothers who have had the vaccine. You know, now, it may be completely coincidence. You know, there are cot deaths. So it is possible, but the way that we're approaching analysing this, any discussion of the dangers or the risks of vaccines are banned from the mainstream media. They literally remove that information. I've had friends who've been told they're not even allowed to post the link to the yellow card, government yellow card scheme website.
Well, we did I put something up on YouTube from last week's show, which was an interview with Stanley Laham from Florida University, a retired immunologist, and it was about the flu vaccine. Discussing the way that had been getting less and less effective, and that in 2018 there were so many deaths due to the flu at the highest rate that there'd ever been, the vaccine had ever been, in the US. He was just talking about the US, and that was removed from YouTube, which I thought, I had a look at their guidelines, it doesn't even talk about flu vaccines. So we were talking about a flu vaccine, but anything to do with vaccines, it seems now, is taboo.
Vaccines are the wonder treatment, so long which as it, we need it, to make sure that 7
it's
billion
an,
it's people
like an advert for them.
It's been, I mean, my own feeling is that the last 12 months have been a sort of a dystopian advert for flu, for vaccines. And it's, you know, if the pharmaceutical industry had been asked to pay for it all, it would have cost them billions and billions. Instead of that, they're just making billions and billions. They don't have to advertise it at all because the government and the medical industry are all doing that. And I mean, just me saying the words medical industry seems so alien to me, but that is what it feels like. You know, this medical, even the NHS is being brought into disrepute. It's been, you know, the whole thing, it's about saving the NHS, protecting the NHS. It's instead of, let's make sure that we look after people as best we can. So we've known from way back when, you know, March last year, that this virus disproportionately affected the elderly and the vulnerable. So the the scheme, you know, what we'd have done with the pandemic planning is to say, how do we protect the elderly and the vulnerable? And it may have meant that we'd actually ask the people in care homes to live with their residents and not go home to their families at night for 6 weeks, you know, literally. And I know the people who live in, work in those care homes would have gladly done that for their residents. They wanted to protect them. Meanwhile, the rest of us could have just gone about our normal business. It's in most people, you don't even know you've had the COVID, and in some people, you get a bad illness. But in terms of hospitalization and death, it's extremely rare in under 70s, under 60s, who've got no other illness. So we've approached it completely wrong. If people want to read more about that, then look up the Great Barrington Declaration, which is eminent doctors, eminent scientists who've produced that and said, look, this is how we should be handling it. And this idea of lockdowns, masks, locking borders, all these other things, which have been proven not to work, and yet somehow we behave as if they do. And, you know, it's
well,
just
you say they've been proven not to work. I mean, how do you mean? But how do you prove something like that? Surely it's an obvious, intuitive thing. If you stop people travelling, then a disease is going to stop travelling too.
Unfortunately, that doesn't happen. You know, you have to look at why the Indian variant has gone from India all the way to England and not actually stopped off in any. You know, is it just the flights? Is it what? The viruses travel very, very easily. Seasonal respiratory, the flu just works its way around the world. They're both seasonal respiratory viruses.
Anyway, look, what were you saying about vaccines there? It's pretty worrying. Martin, you've had your vaccine. Have you had number one, number two?
I'm getting the second jab next week.
And it's the AstraZeneca one. You were talking about gene therapy. So AstraZeneca, is that or is that
AstraZeneca
not?
AstraZeneca is not one of the gene. No, that's Pfizer and Moderna are the mRNA.
Martin was coming to you saying, oh, look, I want to have my vaccine, what sort of things as a GP would you advise him to help him make that decision?
Yeah, I would advise him to look up what the risks and benefits are. So the benefits are potentially you get a milder COVID. It seems to reduce hospital admission. So, well, you know, from that point of view. But if you're also somebody in your, you know, 40s, 50s or 60s or 30s or 20s, then the chances of you having to go into hospital are very slim. And there are risks to it. There's certainly blood clot risks with the Oxford.
They're tiny, aren't they? Surely. I mean, we keep hearing about the
one in 100,000.
I'm afraid I'm a cynic, and I think that some of these stories about the Oxford AstraZeneca blood clots are put out there by Pfizer just to scare people into having the Pfizer vaccine.
That's a very important point because we talk about the vaccine.
And yeah, there are different versions,
vaccines, because of course the Russians and the Chinese have developed their own vaccines, which are not produced under a for-profit situation. The Cubans have produced their own vaccines. So in other words, when we talk about the vaccine and being anti-vaxxers, we've got to unpick what we're
anti-vaxxing is a pejorative term. It's, you know, there's a number of pejorative terms going around.
Almost like anti-Semitic or something.
Basically means you can dismiss anything that people say by just, listen to
it. It's like calling someone a fascist. Anyway, look, we've kind of strayed away from Ian's mum's story. So what happened?
Back at Glenview. Halfway through December, I received a phone call, as I say, saying, you know, your mum could have a jab. So consented, and she had her jab. And then in January, I had a phone call from the home saying, your mum's not very well. Would you mind if she goes to hospital? I said, well, no, obviously get her in the hospital if she needs some support. When she got to hospital, I got a phone call from the consultant who was looking after her, who expressed some safeguarding concerns. Apparently my mum had some bed sores and they were quite significant.
Right, so maybe sores. Potentially she hadn't been being properly looked after, maybe.
Well, it was enough for the hospital to raise safeguarding concerns with the council, and the council to take action against the home. And get some things changed. I'm unaware of what those are yet. I'm still waiting on my replies back from the care home, etc. But I do know that Care and Quality Commission were involved, etc. And the hospital were unhappy with my mother returning to the
to the care home.
Okay, so this is an enormous issue in here, because you've been denied access to your mum.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, she's...
been neglected.
Yeah.
To the point she's had to go to hospital. Now, she went into hospital with... and when she arrived at a hospital on 12th of January, the hospital said she had a COVID-19 test for which she was positive. And then treatment was commenced. My mum was at the end of her life. I'm fully aware of that, you know. She was quite bright on some days, other days completely confused, as happens with Alzheimer's, dementia. The long and short was that my mother died on the 29th of January, I think it was. And that is what it is.
She was a COVID statistic, I imagine. Which had she died within the time of having the test?
Yeah. She died within 28 days of having a positive COVID test. So she was counted, and COVID-19 was listed as a primary cause.
Okay,
of death.
So do you know how long after the test she died? How many weeks or days or whatever?
She went in on the 12th of January and tested positive then, and she was dead on the 29th of January.
Okay.
So within 28 days of a positive test, so she would have been counted. I was dubious that my mother had COVID-19. Purely because she'd had her vaccine in December of the previous year. And from what I understand, the difference between PCR and lateral flow tests and the amount of cycles that are applied, that you can get quite a lot of false positives. So I was also concerned that on no part of the original death certificate did it mention my mother's neglect or her precious orders that were significant. As even contributing to the cause of death. So I objected to the cause of death on the death certificate. Now, there was a bit of to and fro between the council, Public Health England and the hospital. And 3 days before my mother's funeral, they pulled the funeral and referred the case to the coroner. Which was should have happened weeks beforehand, you know. But I felt that they were putting administrative pressure on to try and get my mum cremated before any form of autopsy could be undertaken. So I pushed it, and we got the autopsy undertaken.
I mean, this is not the most pleasant thing to have to go through, is it?
No, certainly.
Because you're witnessing there is the people who are supposed to be doing their job, the authorities are simply not doing it. And you have to poke them, pressurise them and push them into actually doing their job.
Yeah, and I've got questions for, you know, the GP that gave my mum her COVID jab out of White Ladies Road practice. You know, is if she had significant pressure sores, why didn't they raise any safeguarding concerns? You know,
because well, they may not have seen them, possibly.
Well,
anyway,
they were providing care to my mother, who was an Alzheimer's.
Well,
patient.
It's also awful to have to try and sort of push and insist on having an inquest when you hope that the authorities are going to do their job. So anyway, what was that process like about getting an autopsy and that sort of thing?
It's frustrating. I mean, to be fair, the coroner was their office was perfectly sound, very fine in their service. The PALS team at the BRI have been very good. I haven't had any contact really from the council, to be fair, but they're on my list. But the long and short was when the results of the pathology came through, I got these weeks, my mum didn't have COVID and died of bronchial pneumonia. Which, a lot of people with end-of-life Alzheimer's succumb to. And I believe my mum's probably one of the only people in the country who've died of bronchial pneumonia this last year.
Is it an easy mistake to make for the doctor writing out the death certificate, John?
I don't think it's an easy mistake to make. I think it's just what is being asked of doctors right since last March 2020. Certainly, I have a relative who died in not totally dissimilar situations. And they, even though she hadn't had a PCR test or anything, or hadn't been put, they wanted to put COVID down on the death certificate because that's what they'd been instructed to do. I think we've also got Belle Mooney was talking in one of the articles in the newspaper about 2 months ago, similar situation with her parent who was also described as having COVID, which, you know, she didn't. So it's part of what's going on appears to be to say that people die of COVID, even though that's, you know, doesn't seem actually what they've died of. And, you know, I've heard ambulance men saying, you know, when we get called to a sudden death at home, you know, you say it's suspected COVID, and then there doesn't need to be any further investigation. So the coroners, you know, the coroners are not, are basically having to... Well, it's really unusual, actually, to get post-mortems these days. Very difficult to get a post-mortem, particularly if there's COVID on the death certificate.
So, but you managed to do that?
Yes, because I formally objected to the cause of death on the death certificate, and I reminded the hospital that it's a criminal offence to misreport the cause of death.
I suppose that there's also a psychological pressure here, John, is that most families who've lost a loved one, that's the last thing they want to do, is to try and take on the system.
Absolutely, but there will be thousands upon thousands of people out there right now who think, I don't think my mum or I don't think my dad died of COVID. They put COVID down. If you die of COVID, it implies that somehow you've done, you know, you haven't protected them, because the way that we're behaving with COVID is that if someone catches COVID, then somebody must be to blame for it. And so, you know, the question is, you know, did the care home, were other people infected? How did she get it? There is a work by a chap called Joel Smalley. He did a fabulous tweet earlier this week, which basically just tracked the course of COVID deaths in different countries. And what it showed was that the COVID deaths went up and down, basically over Christmas, different times, different places. But when the vaccinations start, in a good third of countries, the deaths from COVID started to go up again, went up and peaked. And that certainly happened in the UK, in England, where we had a peak of COVID in the lead up to Christmas. The peak was dropping away, and then suddenly it starts to go up again to another peak in early January. And that second peak is almost, you know, is literally 3 or 4 weeks after vaccinating of the very elderly started. So it's, you know, the whole... There's lots of questions, and nobody is asking those questions. I don't know what the truth is, but I want to... I feel that it's the duty of coroners, it's the duty of doctors, it's the duty of us all to find out what is actually going on.
But I'm afraid human nature is people take the path of least resistance. Is there pressure on doctors, do you think, to, number one, vaccinate, and number two, put COVID on death certificates?
I think there's huge pressures on doctors to do those. Yeah, it's... If a death is described as being due to COVID, that is the end of the matter. It does not, literally, it does not need to go to the coroner. It does not need to go, you know, there's it only needs one. Now, the new rules mean they introduced some rules to protect the public from people like Shipman. And they said you must have two doctors to sign cremation forms, and you can't do it without one doctor talking to another to make sure that they've actually covered all the bases in their diagnosis to check it. That was done away with in March last year as part of the Coronavirus Act. It was just said, no, now just one doctor can do it. It is astonishing what changes have been made under the so-called emergency, and an emergency where 2 in 1,000 die. It is not an emergency. We're behaving as if it's the way that we're being told to behave. I literally walked down the Gloucester Road here, and almost everybody is wearing a mask outdoors, you know, as if they're sort of, and yet we're down to 1 in 10,000 people in Bristol have COVID at the moment. 1 in 10,000. And almost certainly they're all false positives. So you're literally, you've got this crazy situation where we are behaving as
Why do you think they're all false positives?
Because you've got a certain number of false positives, usually, because there is no evidence that they're true positives. These people have not got...
But there's no evidence they're false either, is there?
The guy who invented the PCR test said you cannot use it as a diagnostic test.
But they are.
Using it as a diagnostic test. And if you look at the way that all these tests are done, they talk about sort of 99% sensitive, 99% specific. You know, that would mean that 1 in 100 are false positives. If you did a pregnancy test on 1,000 men, one of them would be positive. That would be a false positive. I can guarantee it. There are always false positives to tests.
Well, you're never sure these days. Ian, if you could just wrap up your tale. You've got the information there in front of you from the coroner. Do you feel satisfied that you've got to the truth now?
I'm getting there. There are more stones to be unturned, I think. Going back to the death certificate thing, is I also believe that nursing homes can sign off their own death certificates if COVID's confirmed or suspected.
Is that right, John? Do you know?
I don't know. I've heard that said before, but I mean, it's the rules around that. It still needs, I think, a medical person to sign off the death certificate, but it may well be that they don't need to actually go and see the body or something like that. Yeah. That if they're basically told that this has happened, there are big concerns about the fact that doctors are running, GPs are running their services from their own homes, literally over Zoom and phone and Skype, and not actually seeing people face to face. And you think, why? What's happening with this?
The issue I have around that whole death certificate process is that at home we're very reticent about my mother going into hospital, and I believe they knew that once she got into hospital, safeguarding concerns would have been raised due to her condition.
Yeah, this is again. This is the care homes are. Most of them are run for money. You know, that's what they're there to do. They're there to take money, and the idea that suddenly there's no one there around to check, the family's not around to check, John.
It really worries me. I mean, there's been some very distressing stories about people who've wanted to take their relatives out of care homes and so on. You know, we were lucky, you know, having people at the end of their life deserve time with their family. They deserve hugs. They deserve hand-holding. And the idea that somehow everybody is infectious or could be infectious, it's such a strange idea.
Well, Dr. David Halpin has been on here. He's down in Dartmoor, but he was one of the people who flagged up the death of Dr. David Kelly as very suspicious, the official story not being correct. He's called it evil.
Yeah, I think what is happening at the moment could be described as evil. It feels certainly very wrong.
So whether you have access to your parents is determined by some insurance company. This is bizarre, isn't it? Why do you think they're doing that, Ian?
Well, eugenics.
Well, it's just money. It's surely money, isn't it? I mean, we have a certain risk here and we don't care about the human side of it. We're just looking at some sort of a risk. But, I mean, you know, that's a question. Bringing up this whole idea of eugenics, I think, John, what do you make of that? The idea that, these people, there's too many people on the planet, there are certain people in the way, you know, that's a big, big question to bring up.
That's a particular rabbit hole I wouldn't want to go down.
Martin?
Well, I mean, the views of somebody like Bill Gates on population control are pretty well known. I think we've got to be very careful when we're having these discussions, though, to break it up into every little individual bit. So, for example, talking about masks is not the same as talking about vaccines. Whatever your views, the two things are different.
Absolutely.
And I think what's happening is
made that clear. We've been talking about these things separately.
I know, but what can happen is that people just download one set of views from their social media feed, as it were, about this.
Okay, well,
and
let's
another
just
set
try
of views for another set of people. And what we really need to do is...
I don't think we're doing that at all.
No,
Martin,
I know we're not doing that here, but anyway, that's what's going on in general.
Can we? Well, possibly. I mean, yeah. Anyway, so I think one of the things that really helps is if we can pin this down to specific cases. I noticed this week there's a guy who's a hairdresser, Tony Napolitano, who's had quite a few people coming into his hairdressing salon. Now it's all open again. But he decided he was going to actually interview for Twitter or Facebook or social media of some sort this lovely little old lady that came in, because she was talking about having a bad reaction to a vaccine. And we'll have a chat to Dr. John Rogers after we've heard this about what you think of it.
Just to warn other people that with these vaccinations, they carry some side effects. They can carry some extreme side effects. So what I'll ask, because this client came in my shop quite distressed, really. So I'm going to hand over to her. Could you please tell us what happened to you?
Yes, I went for my first injection in January 25. Seemed to be okay, going all right. And then the early part of March, I noticed these big lumps coming on my leg. I went to the doctor and she said, I think it's thrombosis. So they sent me to the hospital confirmed it was thrombosis. Not only that, but I didn't know whether to have the second injection or not. I was completely lost. I phoned 119, I phoned 111, I contacted my GP, I even contacted the centre, and no one knew. In fact, on the day I went there to get my second injection, two doctors told me that if I was prepared to have it, they would do it. But no one could give you any answers. And since that second injection, I have felt so very, very ill. I've also had a friend who was due for an operation on her leg, but it wasn't giving her that much pain. She had the injections and she's on a stick now. She's aged about 10 years. With the second one, I was told, oh yeah, you might get pain for a couple of days or something like that, and that was it. I'm all very high on my medicines anyway, because I'm not well, but they've only given me the tablet to thin the blood. That's all I've had on this particular one, apart from my others, because I'm on morphine and everything. I feel everything's been brushed aside. No one knows what they're doing. You go to your doctors, you see someone who doesn't know you. It, to my mind, it's just a whole load of crap. I'm not saying that about the nurses who pull hard and everything, and the doctors, but the whole organisation just doesn't work.
Okay.
Okay, so that's the famous, apparently, hairdresser Tony Napolitano there talking to one of his clients about quite a nasty reaction, apparently, to the vaccine. Now, I suppose, you know, if you were a vaccine manufacturer, you would say, well, it's nothing to do with the vaccine. She would have got that anyway.
Complete coincidence, obviously. This is one of the difficulties, obviously, is actually identifying what is due to vaccines and what's not. But what is my distinct impression is that the NHS seems to be going out of its way to discount vaccines as being a cause of side effects and reactions, and preferring to just assume it wasn't the vaccines. So, again, talking to an ambulance driver colleague, you know, there are some ambulance men, when they go to someone at home, their first question is, have you had your vaccine? Because it's so common to have serious side effects to them, and others that say, no, you don't talk about it. And literally that there seem to be a lot of doctors who are not reporting things as suspected. You don't have to know that it is due to the vaccine. You just have to report the association. And for example, the blood clots, which were linked to the AstraZeneca vaccine, were visible in the data from January, and yet it took sort of other countries in Europe to announce that they were going to suspend use of it. So it does feel very it does feel as if everybody, that the NHS and the government are rooting blindly for vaccines rather than saying, look, let's have a balanced perspective on this. It doesn't feel at all but balanced.
Well, there's one particular reason for that, and that is potentially, anyway, profits for the pharmaceutical industry. Anyway, we had a big announcement this week about vaccines, again, from Matt Hancock. Well, there's various things he was talking about, which is to do with international travel. But vaccines, obviously, featured massively there. So let's have a listen to this now, and then maybe we can hear from our resident doctor today, John Rogers, about whether he
retired
thinks...
Retired doctor.
Matt Hancock's advice is good about vaccines.
Uptake of the first dose has been phenomenally high, and we followed the strategy of getting first doses to as many people who are vulnerable to COVID as possible, as quickly as possible. And for that, read the over 50s in particular. Now, you can see the very, very high uptake rates, and we're incredibly proud of how much people have stepped forward. But there's still a little bit of a gap between the green bars and the 100%. And what the experience of Bolton shows is it's incredibly important that we get vaccination even to the final few percent and encourage that take up. And then the blue bars show the second doses, and we can see that the uptake of the second doses has been incredibly high too. But again, there's a little bit of green showing, and we need to get the blue bars, the second doses, up to everybody who's had the first dose. And of course, as you go down the age range towards the left of the chart, fewer people have had two doses because it has been less time since they had the first dose. This is why getting the second dose in to those who are most vulnerable to ending up in hospital and dying of the disease is so important. Academic studies have shown that this decision to have 12 weeks between the first two doses has saved around 12,000 lives. But that uptake, those figures, are not yet 100%, and we will not rest until we get them there. And crucially, this acceleration now of second doses for the over 50s, for the most vulnerable, is all about getting the maximum possible protection for those at greatest risk.
Yes. The vaccination program has been a huge success in terms of getting it out to lots and lots of people, and people actually clamoring for vaccines. So from that perspective, he's absolutely right. Has been successful. It slightly worried me that he was talking about the few percent that haven't had them, and somehow that's got to be a priority. But people choose not to have it. It should be a choice. It's an informed choice. People should be able to decide whether they want to have a vaccine or not. It should not be up to the state to coerce them. We talked about coercion earlier, about the fact that you'd be able to meet your relatives if they've been vaccinated or you've been vaccinated. You'll be able to travel abroad if you've been vaccinated, but not if you haven't been vaccinated. It seems as if rather than recognising that there are different thoughts, different opinions on it, it's saying everybody should be vaccinated, and that implies coercion.
Surely, if you haven't been vaccinated, you're a danger to everyone else.
There's no evidence at all that that's the case. There's no evidence that it reduces transmissibility, or even that you catch. Whether you catch COVID, it just all the evidence on the vaccines has been that it stops you getting seriously ill, which is a really good benefit from it. But it does not say that it stops you spreading it. The idea of vaccine passports and other steps as a way of eradicating the disease, it's not accurate to say that.
I'd concur. It's not accurate at all, and I've got real concerns on the stats and the expert views that the government constantly put forward. You know, if you get shot by a lightning bolt and you've had COVID in the last 28 days and you're dying from COVID, you know, or if you fly through the side of a van like some poor motorcyclist did a little while back, you're counted as a COVID death. But if you have the vaccine and you die within 28 days of having the vaccine, it's nothing to do with the vaccine. You know, and our government, along with every other government, is disingenuous in portraying the expert view and statistics and then coercing you into behaviour and into systems that you would never normally consent
to.
Well,
this is really, surely, this is the pharmaceutical industry pushing these things, isn't it? I mean, that seems to me that they want vaccines, and the government are just doing what the pharmaceutical industry want.
Well, yeah, and the WHO changed their definition of a pandemic to make this a pandemic. They changed their guidance. You've got flip-flop Fauci, you know, the 2 masks, 5 masks, how many masks do you want? You know, you've got people even having anal swabs, you know. What is that about? To control a virus that kills, or sorry, that 99.99% of people don't even know they've had.
So the bottom line with all of this is a regulation of which medicines can and can't be used and techniques and that sort of thing. This group, the MHRA, is supposed to sign these vaccines off as safe, John. But, I mean, surely we all know that they're experimental. So
it's, not everyone sort of knows that they're experimental. I mean, that's one of the problems, that people assume that they're not going to be given something unless it's approved. But these have not been approved anywhere in the world. They're all the vaccines, and as Martin says, there are different vaccines. They have different modes of action, but none of them have been approved. They've all been authorized to be used for emergency purposes. So that the whole emergency authorization, as opposed to approval, the trials were supposed to go on until 2022, 2023. A lot of those trials have stopped early. So because people who were in those trials have been told whether they had the vaccine or whether they had a placebo or whether they had a meningitis vaccine, so that they are able to go and get the full vaccine later. But that automatically means you're going to have no comparison group in 2 years' time to say, it looks like people who had this vaccine seem to have more of this condition or more of that condition, or people who didn't have it seem to be, you know, we seem to have thrown out all the principles of good scientific assessment and analysis.
Well, we don't seem to learn. This is the problem I have with these regulators, like the MHRA, that's approved these vaccines for use, because we've just had in the news this week the thousands of PIP breast implants scandal victims. They should receive compensation. A court has ruled women have been fighting for justice for 10 years after receiving breast implants which leaked silicone into their bodies, leaving them with a wide range of health issues. This happened about 10 years ago or so, and the MHRA director resigned as a result. And then we had another scandal at the MHRA, which was the mesh to do with bladders.
Prolapse repair, yeah.
That was another scandal. The MHRA had approved that incredibly without any testing whatsoever, approved it for use in the human body. So it seems to me that if you've got some sort of new product that you want to get out onto the health market, then you just pick up the phone to the MHRA and they tick the boxes and you can sell it and it can be used in, you know, it doesn't seem to really be any regulation anymore.
That's certainly how I feel. But even suggesting that there isn't immediately means you're a conspiracy theorist or an anti-vaxxer. But the truth is, I want to see safe and effective medications, and that includes vaccines, but we should be absolutely clear about how safe they are and how effective they are.
I mean, just looking at what I've just been saying there, it doesn't sound like they may well not be safe at the moment. We've got June Rain in charge of the MHRA. These previous bosses there, Clive Bray and John Wilkinson, have both been sacked over other failings of that organisation.
I mean, I think there are big questions about the way that the MHRA works and operates. There was adverts back in October for a new IT system, an artificial intelligence system, to sift through the thousands and thousands of expected adverse reactions, or 500,000, I think they're now up to see if there were any defining trends or any changes. But it doesn't feel like people are sending these reports in. A lot of people aren't bothering to send reports in. So again, you know, it's certainly a lot. I've literally heard a radio interviewer describing how she was in bed for 3 days. This is a woman, I guess is in her 30s, describing how grateful she was to get her vaccine early because of the travel benefits. But she was in bed for 3 days after the vaccine. And no, she didn't put in any adverse reaction because it showed that the vaccine was working. And you think, That just doesn't make sense. It does not. And you just imagine if you're a person in their 80s or 90s and you get something that lays you up, that will lays up a 30 or 40 year old, things. What does that have, effect does,
well,
that have on
that? This discussion
person?
We had last week, which YouTube decided was banned, was looking at the flu vaccine and how in 2018 it became absolutely clear statistically the flu vaccine wasn't working. The vaccine companies now have got a new game, and everyone's forgotten about the flu vaccine failure. They're now doing something completely different, something completely new. Anyway, just as some closing comments, Ian, I wonder what you make of, you know, the system that you've come up against with your mum.
It seems to be like every system that I've ever been involved with that Bristol City Council has a hand in, you know, is not fit for a purpose. Regulations are never followed. Paperwork is never completed, and the city leadership seem intent on ignoring the problem and hope it goes away.
But anyway, at least it looks as if you've got a result with the inquest, and you know that actually the coroner's done their job here.
Yeah, exactly. And I thank the coroner's office for doing their job. You know, it was a shame that I had to push for the coroner to become involved. You know, that should have been automatic.
Well, it makes me wonder immediately how many other people were thinking, what can I do, but didn't have the nous to do what you did and get the coroners to take a closer look.
Well, I've never been one to shrink from a fight.
No, you haven't. You know. Anyway, look, thanks ever so much for joining us, Ian. Anyway, we're going to hear now an aspect to do with the fear of all of this, because there's a new book out called The State of Fear by a woman called Laura Dodsworth, who's looking at the use of behavioural psychology in the mass media.
I keep an eye on the job ads, and they don't stop recruiting behavioural scientists. This is really big business. Mm. Unfortunately, the business of fear is big business now for the government, and it really disturbs me because I don't think this is the way to work towards what we imagine society should look like. You know, in a democracy, you don't try and persuade people subtly beneath the level of their consciousness. Mm. You give them the facts and you let them make up their mind about what they want to do. Or you have laws and mandates. You know, then at least people know what they're up against. The thing about this very heavy use of behavioural psychology we have is that people are being subliminally manipulated without knowing. What it does is strip choice away. But the use of fear is particularly disturbing. Now, if a psychologist wanted to scare you in a lab, you would have to sign a consent form. You'd have to agree to the process. Mm. And you would leave the lab very happy. You know, they'd make you watch a happy film and give you a slice of chocolate cake. You know, we're not getting happy films and chocolate cake. What we're getting is more nudge. Mm. It just hasn't stopped. You know, I was nodding along as you introduced the show, because here we are, the day after our restrictions are being released. And actually, you know, we're having more scary things dangled over us to keep the level of alarm high. As you said, the so-called Indian variant hasn't actually caused any big problems for us yet, and yet we're being told that might be why restrictions can't be released on the 21st of June.
But this is their favourite word, isn't it? Their favourite word is could, might. You never hear them actually saying anything specifically, this will happen. They never use that terminology.
I think that's a really good point. And actually, that's quite tortuous for people, because people need certainty and they need deadlines. This is a little bit like Christmas. Do you remember? It was on, it was off, it was on, it was off. And that really caused a lot of distress and stress for people. It's this huge celebration. It's one of the most important days in our calendar. We didn't know what was happening.
Yeah.
And now everyone's had the 21st of June to look forward to. We were told we could cry freedom by Easter. And now we've been told it might be retracted. But I think there's something that's behind this. And you see, it is the nudging. Mm. Look at the language around the vaccine. We're being told that vaccine refuseniks will hold up the easing of restrictions. But this is quite a dangerous path to go down. You know, othering people and dehumanising people and using critical language to scapegoat them just creates a blame game among people and a lot of ill will.
Yeah.
And it creates fear. You know, which team do you want to be in? Do you want to be in the nasty team that's keeping everybody in lockdown, well, do you want to be on the good heroic team that's had the jab?
Right.
It's, I don't think it's a very nice way to encourage people to have a medical intervention. You know, tell people how effective it is, make it available. Don't tell people that they're holding up lockdown for everyone else. It's a tactic of fear, again.
Yeah. It's a demonising tactic in the same way that Neil O'Brien, the Tory MP, who's now sitting happily in the cabinet, apparently responsible for the levelling up of the country, decided to start compiling a list of journalists that he thought might be refuseniks in some way, people who might be dissidents, you know, the sort of thing that the former Soviet Union would have done, the former, you know, gulag merchants would have done, to say, off you go, get re-educated, we don't want you talking like this because you're upsetting people.
So that was on the Mike Graham programme on Talk Radio on Tuesday morning. Her name is Laura Dodsworth. Her book is called The State of Fear. Now, this is behavioural psychology that's being used here in advertising. The idea is that people's buttons are being pushed, unconscious buttons are being pushed.
Yeah, I mean, it's not even secret. It's not, you know, it's been in the sage minutes. There's been notes about it, that how they need to ratchet up the fear, increase the perceived threat, because people aren't worried enough about it. So if you cause a population to be increasing fear, then they're easier to control. They basically go along with whatever they're being told to do. But it also means that people behave in ways that they wouldn't normally behave, and the changes in behavior we've seen schools now saying we don't want the children in our schools, we'll teach them from home, even though home teaching is pretty useless. We've got teachers who are saying we don't want our children in the classroom. Now they're saying, oh, we'll have them in the classroom, but they have to wear masks. All these people are saying these things not because that is the logical thing to say. They're saying them because that is what they have taken from this fear-laden propaganda which we've had for over a year.
We've got a kind of groupthink, haven't we, Martin? This is it reminds me a little bit of the all the stuff around 9/11, you know, the sort of shock and awe. You know, we've got Al-Qaeda on the doorsteps and everyone better run and hide. The use of fear, actually, fear is an extremely powerful weapon.
Yeah, it can be, and of course we've been talking about the pharmaceutical industry's role, but of course the government now sees the vaccine programme as a central part of its sell to the British people. So whatever their views about this, that, you know, the right wing of the Conservative Party, the COVID research group as they call themselves, have bitten their tongues over this, even though they've been pretty much agreeing with John's views on lockdown. They've been biting their tongues about this, and they're pushing the idea of vaccines as a solution.
That's right, and in fact we keep hearing, don't we, the vaccine program's been a wonderful success, has it, John?
Well, I mean, it certainly has. You've got everybody over the age of, I think everybody over the age of 50 who wants the vaccine has been offered it.
Well, that's right, because they say, don't they? They keep saying everyone's had the vaccine over such. What they really mean is these people have been offered a vaccine. Yeah. And you're seeing roughly, I mean, even within the medical profession, something like a quarter just refusing the vaccine.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly, I've chosen not to have the vaccine.
You can't say, well, my point here, I'm trying to say here, is you can't say it's been a success until a bit further down the line, where we can see if these vaccines, experimental vaccines, have actually worked.
I think there's big questions about it. The fact that they're still insisting that, you know, we've got to lock down. If the vaccines work, then once people who are vulnerable have been offered the vaccine and have had the vaccine if they want it, then if they work, you don't need to have lockdown, you don't need to have masks, you don't have to have social distancing, even if you believe that they were useful. If the vaccines don't work, then frankly, we've got a whole different set of problems. But from my perspective, this idea that it seems to be continuing the fear, it's very coercive. The fact that you're told, yes, it's okay, no, it's not, yes, it is. You know, even things like the Indian variant have sort of come in, then there's sort of receding risk, then you've got another person saying it. It's always designed to make you uncertain about what things. So you grasp the only certainty that you can have, which is, oh, in that case, I better get the vaccine. Oh, I better do this. I better follow the rules. I better do those things, because you're left in a situation where you are fearful if you don't. And the message is that if you don't wear a mask, if you don't have a vaccine, then basically you are a antisocial person who wants to kill my granny. It's ridiculous. It's so overhyped.
Well, I'm actually my only fear in this is having something injected into me that I don't know what it is and I don't know what it does. And one of the major problems with this is that these are commercial vaccines that you're not actually allowed to know the details of exactly how it's made. These are patented things. What we're doing tonight is some almost like a studio version of the last weekend's protests here in Bristol,
right?
Because we're talking a lot about the whole Palestine issue, which was in Castle Park. I don't know if you went along to that one, Martin. Did you last week?
I did, yeah.
And then John and I we were both at a much smaller protest of about 500-600 people on College Green about the lockdown, and I was asked to speak there. Otherwise, I probably would have gone to the Palestine March. And anyway, I'm going to one on Sunday, so I'm doing a bit of both. So so we are sort of like a microcosm of the protest world, because what happens when the mass media and the government do the wrong thing is people come out onto the streets, and that's what they've been doing. We've got I suppose five different movements now, haven't we? We've got the Black Lives Matter, probably most importantly here first in Bristol, and the Edward Colston statue. We've got the anti-lockdown movement. We've got the Palestine people. Any others?
The nurse pay was another issue this last weekend.
Well, I mean, you've got to mention the people who came out to defend the statues
and
Kill
the Bill.
Kill the Bill as well.
I mean, we've got five major protests. What we've got, I think, is we've got basically a political crisis on our hands, where the government is not doing loads of stuff, and so people are having to come out on the streets and to talk about it.
Well, it's not just
demand.
It's not just in this country. I mean, we're going through.
Well, maybe other countries have seen this.
This is the biggest inflection point since World War II.
So what's going on? What's the bigger picture? Why all this protest right now? I mean, you and I, Martin, have been following for many years protest movements, political protests in other countries, which have then been used to cause coups and revolutions, but often by the West.
Well, the COVID crisis is only part of the crisis. The banking system collapsed in the US in September 2019, just before the COVID crisis kicked in. And when they collapsed in 2000...
Well, it doesn't collapse because it gets bailed out.
No, yes, it didn't collapse because it got bailed out. But in 2008, where people were very aware that there was a bailout, because a mechanism had to be put in place to bail the banks out.
Yes.
What happened in 2019 is that behind the scenes, when the crisis hit, they immediately bailed the banks out without telling anybody what they were doing, not even the Congress. And Blackstone, who are basically a private equity firm, took over running policy for the US government, both the Federal Reserve and the Treasury, basically farmed it out to them.
Sounds like the pharmaceutical industry taking over policy
The point is, it's not just the pharmaceutical industry, is what I'm coming
to. No, that's right.
Now, the COVID crisis then came along very handily to justify what had happened. Everybody thinks that the banks have been bailed out again because of the COVID crisis, because of the crash that went with it. That's not true. If there hadn't been a COVID crisis, they'd still have had to bail the banks out. And what everybody would be doing, what the hell's going on here? This was supposedly cleared up years ago.
This bailing out is quite a euphemism, really, for just shoveling loads of public money.
Well, that's right.
It's like a bank robbery of the banks on us.
We all know that during this crisis, the super wealthy have got even wealthier, at the same time as lots of people all over the world have lost their jobs, etc., etc. Now, the other thing that underlying all of this may well be, and we've discussed this week after week, Tony, is that this may well be a biological warfare agent,
we'll be coming to that last. But before do that, we'll be talking... Well, John and I both gave our little speeches on College Green last Saturday. But I thought... there was also Tess Laurie was there, who we've heard on this programme several times, from Bath, the evidence-based medicine doctor that's advocating for the use of ivermectin, the antiviral drug, which is incredibly effective but is being banned by YouTube, Facebook, etc., from even being talked about. They say, oh, this is poisonous or something, and you're not allowed to talk about it. Well, actually, it's saving up to 90% of patients if they're gotten early enough with COVID. It's a treatment, a very effective treatment. Listening through the various talks, not John or I. There was one lady at the end. I think she was an 18-year-old student called Shaz, who gave a terrific talk. So I thought we'd just have a little excerpt, 5 minutes from her talk here, because it's a young person really impassioned about what's going on in society, and particularly just not being prepared to put up with the lies that have been being told about this pandemic.
Professor Adam Finn from the University of Bristol told the Times, "We need to be in a position to immunize children, particularly teenagers, promptly and efficiently if we need to." Vaccinate us with what? With experimental gene therapy that has only been safety tested over a period of 6 weeks. On just over 2,000 people, 12 to 15 years of age. Protection and immunity are not achievable through COVID injections. As soon as you get injected with it, you enter a risky, dangerous game with your health and your future. Yeah. Especially dangerous for children and younger generations because that doesn't happen with the vaccine now. Might show up in years in the future when it matters most. Are the yellow card scheme reports of blood clotting in young and healthy enough? How about the various reports of women's menstruating out of their cycles or past menopause? How about the reports of severe pain that leaves women unable to walk for hours and even days? It affects men as well. We haven't even reached the long-term effects yet. Are these the first signs of forced infertility? Time will tell. The emergency for children is that these powerful drug dealers are pushing them to be injected with completely new experimental mRNA shots that have no long-term safety data, but most of all, are not necessary. Yeah. We, the young people, are not susceptible to this virus. The targeted 12 to 15-year-olds cannot give informed consent to any of these treatments. And it's terrifying to think about what will happen to younger generations in the future when they get vaccinated now. Here's something else to think about. Professor Dolores Cahill announced a very important piece of information about future generations. She spoke that there is a lot of reporting that if they take one of the mRNA injections, that their car insurance, life, medical insurance, and mortgage insurance policies are no longer valid. Imagine your future where as young adults starting out in the world and you're not eligible for insurance for the rest of your lives. How does that make you feel? Or does complacency come back to play? I shouldn't have to worry about these things at 18. Young people need to start standing up for their own rights and freedom and start questioning what information is being fed to them. Since we are the voices of future generations, the working public, and innovators, we choose our own life paths. We do this with freedom of choice. We shouldn't have to comply with harmful regulations that are detrimental to both our physical and mental health. Being drip-fed propaganda and disinformation from the time that we start school. From the age of 16, you have the right to informed to consent, which includes the right to refuse. You are allowed to say no. Despite what your schools tell you, and despite what your good-intentioned parents may say. Please, never feel isolated. There are others out there that feel the same. Do some research. Look at facts. Look at real facts. And start to get a clear picture of what's really going on. I encourage you, young people of not only Bristol, but of this planet, to start speaking up for yourselves against the narrative. Do not let nefarious governments dictate your lives and your futures.
So that's Shaz, 18-year-old. John, I think, you know, both you and I listening to that called out her, one of the things she was saying, that you can't get insurance if you've had a vaccine, which I just think is completely not the case. But anyway, freedom of speech, we believe in that. She can say that if she wants to, and that's what they do on College Green.
Absolutely, and that's, you should speak. And I suspect that what Dolores Cahill was saying was that there would be questions about it, and it, you know, any, if you've had say cancer, then you basically may find it difficult to get life insurance and other insurances, and so on. So, you know, who knows what the long term effects of having a vaccine may be if there turn out to be long term effects. But she spoke really eloquently, very, very impressive young lady. Several things that struck me about it. One is how few young people seem to be protesting about the freedoms, their loss of freedoms. They just seem to think, well, we just need to get this vaccine over and done with so we can get our travel vaccine, our vaccine passports, and we can get to venues again and start living life normally.
Well, my impression is there's quite a lot of young people, particularly students at the universities, that have decided that they don't believe in a lot of this simply because they're not vulnerable to, you know, if they're in good state of health, they know, they're not stupid. They know that they don't need to get a vaccine, certainly, and they're not vulnerable to dying of COVID.
That's indeed so. And she talked about the trials that are going on in 12 to 16 year olds and saying that they can't have informed consent. And it's certainly true that you should seek the parents' consent in for any child. But but children can actually consent under something called Gillick competency. This was something, I think, from about the 1980s, where girls wanted to go on the pill but not let their mothers know that they were seeking help. And under the old rules, anybody under 16 had to get their parents' consent, and what that ended up doing was meaning that people, young girls, did not get contraception when perhaps they needed it. So there was a test case with a lady called Mrs. Gillick and her daughter, and it was agreed that it was up to the doctor or the clinician that was dealing with that person to decide whether that young person was actually able to give consent. Now, it was used in those circumstances. It's very strictly, it used to be, certainly. I mean, I say I've been out of medicine now for 10 years, but it was very, there was always encouraged to involve parents in consents for people under 16. But then there was a decision to be made ultimately. But to use that with vaccines, particularly when there's been such a one-sided picture of vaccines, and I know that there have been videos and things being shown in schools which say, you know, roll up for your vaccine, it's great. And there's an video by the Stephen Hawking Foundation. So they've produced a sort of lively video saying how wonderful vaccines are, very one-sided. And an organization I'm involved with, which is the UK Medical Freedom Alliance, have looked at each of the slides in that video. And it's so one-sided. And of course, you know, if you're just saying this is safe and this is effective, then people say, well, if it's safe and effective and it means that I can, you know, do everything I want to do, then let, you know, bring it on. But that is not informed consent.
Also, another person speaking there was a chap called Rod Humphreys, getting into the political side of this, Martin. He's the guy that most definitely called Keir Starmer out in his pub. He didn't want him to come out to the Raven pub. And afterwards, I pinned him down a little bit about his pub, because I was quite interested to know a bit about where it is and what kind of pub it is. But also getting into some of his, you know, political views and health views about what's actually going on.
My name's Rod Humphreys. As you may or may not know, I own half of the Raven pub in Bath.
How do you get to own half a pub?
I kind of did it with a mate, and we were bored one day, and we thought we'd have a pub, so we did. It generally worked out well, we own half each. Never done it before, and I have to tell you, I'm actually a fairly useless barman. I'm okay at washing up, I'm pretty good at peeling potatoes, I can change beer, but I do love it, because, for lots of reasons. I love it because I love my team, We have the most lovely group of people working for us, some of whom have worked for us for 10, 14, 15 years. And I like it because most of the time it's a building full of people who are happy. The Raven is about meeting and talking and drinking and eating, but mainly it's a place where people meet and talk. It's a fundamentally happy, cheerful, positive place, and I love owning half of it. I love being part of it. We don't do music, we don't do TV screens, we don't do jukeboxes, we don't do bad behaviour. So one of our founding principles was that if a woman on her own couldn't come and read a book in a corner without feeling completely comfortable, we shouldn't be doing it. And I hope and believe the Raven is like that all the time. What we do is we care about, it's fairly simple, we do beer and pies, we clean the lines a lot. A lot of being a pub, doing a pub is cleaning stuff. We clean the lines, we serve fresh, lovely beer, we do the best pies you can buy anywhere in the country. It's not complicated, and we're just there. So I can say that, I can say another thing. There is a kind of principle that in a pub, certainly in our pub, everybody's equal. Whether you are an American tourist who's just walked through the door or someone who's been drinking with us for 10 years, you will get your turn at the bar and you will not jump the queue. And we, if you are rude, we will have a word with you, regardless of who you are. And either way, yes. So I don't know if I've explained that well, but it has an intrinsic equality to it, a pub. The day we first closed the pub was horrible. That building has been so full of life and people meeting and talking since we've had it. To turn it into this cold, dead thing was horrible. And for all our regulars, all the generally old men who come and sit at the bar and talk and do the crossword together, for them to be evicted effectively from what is in many ways their family, their social network, was horrible. It was also horrible for all the young men and fewer young women who worked for me. All their lives were put on hold. All their social life was thrown away. They were pushed into their own little bedsits in the city or wherever they lived. And that felt cruel, pointless, and, yeah, horrible. Why have they been so against pubs? Maybe because, you know, wasn't this true of coffee houses before? And now it's pubs. It's places where people meet and talk. And maybe that's one of the things they haven't wanted to have happen any more than necessary. I don't know. We have social media, so maybe that's not true.
There's a conspiracy theorist publican there, all right. And that's Rod Humphreys from the Raven Pub in Bath, who famously screamed at Keir Starmer that he didn't want him in his pub, mainly over the issue of masks in schools. And he felt that Keir Starmer hadn't been doing his job, hadn't been opposing what the government was trying to do, John.
I mean, he was brandishing printouts, I think, from the Lockdown Skeptics website, which was showing that the excess deaths, you know, were not happening. And why was Keir Starmer advocating for more lockdowns and more draconian measures rather than advocating for opening up the economy and opening up businesses and opening up things? Because it's disproportionately affecting the poor and the working class.
Yeah, well, why was he, Martin?
Well, I mentioned two focus groups earlier, and the Labour Party does its own focus groups. And in actual fact, the government was perceived until the vaccine rollout to have been remiss in protecting the population from this threat, whatever it is.
And well, surely it was overprotecting.
Well, I would disagree. And Keir Starmer, of course, whether he disagrees or not, he listens to what the focus groups are telling him. They're very much driven by focus groups, especially, you know, senior politicians like that. And the kind of talk we're having here is perfectly legitimate, but of course in the mainstream where elections are decided, the majority do tend to go along with the general consensus view about this stuff. Now,
well, I don't agree with that at all, Martin. I think if you had a party which was, you know, in a general election, which was actually criticising Boris, then they'd do very, very well. I think he's an absolutely appalling Prime Minister. This is what Rod Humphreys is saying here, is you've not been challenging him. You've just been going along with it all.
Well, I mean, on other issues, I think that's absolutely correct. But you will find that Boris Johnson has had a problem with his own right wing, who tend to agree with the anti-lockdown views that have been expressed this evening. The Labour Party, on the other hand, has gone for the, what you might call the centre ground, which is that there is a threat and that people have been doing their best to sort of do play by the rules, which is why when they really lost support was when Dominic Cummings went to Barnard Castle. Because whatever you think about what's happening, if we're all obeying the rules, if somebody does that, then that undermines the situation completely. Well, and they lost 20 points of opinion.
Yeah, but it's a fantasy, isn't it, to think that everyone's obeying the rules?
Well, up to that point, people had, and after that point, they were not prepared to in the same kind of way.
Well, we had loads of examples of politicians in Scotland and elsewhere.
Well, I'm just stating the facts, Tony. What happened to the Tory opinion poll lead? Because, of course, at the beginning of the crisis, their lead went up.
You're getting into dodgy territory when you're talking about opinion polls. Because in the middle of a Conservative government, the Labour should be trouncing
all
the
right,
Tories.
Listen, I'm just talking about what happened last year in the opinion polls, which is what politicians take a lot of notice of, for obvious reasons. It's their bread and butter. The opinion polls at the beginning of the crisis, despite the fact that Boris Johnson made his Brexit speech in the Naval Museum in Greenwich, saying that we were going to keep things open even if other people didn't, and that led to a delay in lockdown, the perception of that was that he got it wrong. But at the same time, there's a tendency to rally round the flag in a crisis. The whole thing of, Captain Tom strolling round his garden and the Blitz spirit and all the rest of it. And
that's propaganda, wasn't it?
Well, of course it is, but it's quite effective, though, isn't it? And the opinion poll for the government went up into the territory where they were nearly reaching 50% approval, because, of course, they only got 43%.
Well, I mean, it didn't do very well for Keir Starmer at the local elections.
Can I just finish, Tony, before you... Can I finish giving the answer?
You're taking a very, very long time to answer.
Okay, well, I'll just...
At the end of the day, in the local elections, the Labour Party did appallingly where they should have been taking, they were losing.
Yes, but that's not because they didn't take an anti-lockdown line, Tony. It's because it's largely to do with Brexit. The Hartlepool by-election was lost long before it happened, because 10,000 people there voted for Nigel Farage's Brexit party at the last election. They weren't standing. They all voted Tory.
Why did the Labour... I mean, we've been through this before. I think you're in serious denial about this. If you wanted to win those votes, you've got to put in a Brexit voter. Well, someone with a pro-Brexit a candidate, and they just refuse to do that.
Well, that may be a tactical error that they made, but the point I would...
Let me
come back to the point.
If you want those Farage votes, you've got to do that, haven't you?
No, not necessarily, because you're not going to win anyway. I mean, there was no hope for the Labour Party to win that by-election.
I don't think you're listening to the voters. You're just taking the voters for granted in the Labour Party.
The Labour Party's
got its own
problem.
It's happened in Bristol too, hasn't it?
No, it's happened in Bristol, and the votes have gone to the Greens, who are actually pro-lockdown and pro-Remain.
Why is Labour taking all its voters for granted? That's why it's hemorrhaging
votes.
Because
the problem is that the first-past-the-post electoral system means, in order to win an election under first-past-the-post, Keir Starmer has got to pull over...
So you're blaming the system?
I am blaming
the
system.
Not the policies.
43% of the
people...
Not
the policies.
The policies have got to be geared to the system that you're in.
And not the personalities. I mean, that's what Rod Humphreys was...
This country is run by an 18th-century... political model, as is the United States of America.
Well, this
no
is
other
Humphreys,
European country is run on that basis.
Rod point is that Labour is not opposing it.
Labour are not opposing things like the spy cops bill, the military bill that they can do anything they want, and the Secret Services can do anything they want. All opposition parties voted against that in the House of Commons. All of them.
Except the Liberal Democrats.
The Labour Party abstained. Can you imagine the Labour Party abstained on a bill to give the Secret Services right to kill? It's astonishing.
It's not just that, actually. There's all sorts of other agencies that are given the right to kill, such as the Gambling Commission and things like this.
It's extraordinary, but of course, other opposition parties had no problem opposing that. What's happened with the Labour Party is the right wing of the Labour Party
are opposition.
Now trying to win an election under first past the post. The left wing of the party had its go. They've come in now, and they're under first past the post, and of course, Keir Starmer should commit to PR. That's what they did in the Labour Party in New Zealand.
Well,
did surely
Keir Starmer should resign and get someone.
Well, he may well have to resign if he loses in Batley and Spen.
With more personality.
Because, of course, it looks like Andy Burnham is on manoeuvres.
Anyway, what do you make of this sort of, you know, the whole business of Rod Humphreys having a go at Keir Starmer, saying you're just not opposing, John?
I mean, I've taken a back seat from politics, really. I was involved with the Remain campaign and the Liberal Democrats, and I literally resigned last year from the Liberal Democrats because of the fact they were did not appear to be worried about all the civil liberties and the freedoms being removed, which they, to be fair, they are now objecting to the coronavirus regulations. They are objecting to human rights losses and the various bills that are going through. I totally agree with Martin that we've got an electoral system that is not fit for purpose. You know, the Labour Party and the Conservative Party both need to split in two. That's what would happen in Europe. They would basically
have normal politics.
Different people, and you could then have things. At the moment, it's just battling within them. So you've got Keir Starmer, who's attempting to squash all the good work that Jeremy Corbyn did. Jeremy Corbyn was attempting to squash all the good work that Tony Blair had done. You know, that literally they are arguing amongst themselves. And that is you've got a situation whereby people look at them and say, a plague on all your houses, I'm not interested. And you get this ridiculous, you know, 40% of the people voting.
At the end of the day, what's happening, though, is the entire democratic system is being discredited here by this
Absolutely.
Whole by this whole process, and people are less interested in voting. The big beneficiaries are the big transnational corporations, the banks, the pharmaceutical industry are sitting there rubbing their hands as all these politicians mess it up.
Yeah, and so many of the big political parties are very dependent on donations from these big multinational companies and
their hedge funds and the rest of them.
It's you know, and you know, the level of cronyism we've seen over the last year, you know, with sort of literally, you know, WhatsApp messages to my mate to sort of make sure he knows about this PPE deal. I've never done PPE. Well, that doesn't matter. You know, just put in a bid and you'll get somebody to do it. You know, literally billions and billions and billions squandered over the last year. But where have the Labour Party, they said, you know, they've not even raised the issue.
They've been very weak on lots of other things.
Okay, but
they've been very good. Annalisa Dodds was extremely good on all these the cronyism.
The problem for them is that it hasn't cut through. They were hoping by raising these kind of issues that people would. The vaccine is actually knocking back the cronyism campaign, if you like.
But the thing is, you both of you are advocating for a change in the system.
Absolutely.
You know, but is it going to happen? No, of course it's not.
Why do you say that,
Well,
Tony?
Because the Conservative Party is in for another 5 years. They're not going to change anything, are they? And it also may even be longer than that if we've got Starmer fighting the Tories at the next election.
Well, but it's certainly possible for if the Labour Party adopts a pro-proportional representation line, you can align a large swathe of people in all the smaller parties. You've got, you know, literally from the right and the left. It's about reducing the authoritarian "you are right, I am wrong" into a libertarian, much more liberal approach, which can be both the liberal left and the liberal right. And you then have a situation whereby you form new alliances which actually allow you to deliver a better electoral system. It's what happens. It actually happens in Scotland, for God's sake. You know.
Yeah. Well, that's right. I mean, I spoke to Fangham Debonair, who's our MP here,
about Labour
MP,
Bristol
and
West.
I said, about yeah. when we were talking about who to vote for in the internal election in the Labour Party, be the leader. And I know she's pretty close to Keir Starmer. And I was saying, well, what I want Keir Starmer to do is commit to PR. Now, what he said, just as Jeremy Corbyn said, is I'm interested in considering this as a possibility once I become Prime Minister. And that's just not good enough. Now, I'm 61 years old, I despair, because it's just such a simple thing to do, because you could then reach out, even at the minimal level, you could say, vote Labour just once, and we'll change the system. At a more fundamental level, you could even actually run, as normal in European countries, a coalition
I think
election.
You're fantasising. Because
no, it's not a fantasy.
Martin, let me just explain why I think you're fantasising. Is because back in 2010, we had the beginnings, we had a referendum, didn't we, on whether to change the voting system at the same time as the general election, and it was booted out by the public. They're not interested in this.
But that was a deeply flawed... I mean, that was part of the Liberal Democrat... Conservative coalition. It was a flawed voting system. So many of the people in the Liberal Democrats saying, well, this isn't really a proportional system, the AV system. The reason it was chosen was because Labour had an alternative vote system in their manifesto. So Nick Clegg naively thought that if he went along with the Labour proposal in their manifesto, that Labour would support him, because he knew the Tories wouldn't. So he thought that that would generate a majority in favour. But then, of course, Labour, quite not unreasonably, decided to use that as we're not going to vote for Nick Clegg's change in voting system.
I just think it's silly, really. Sorry, carry on.
So literally they ended up with a system that we were voting on, a system which was not really a strong proportional system, because it was politically expedient to attempt to pull together a coalition, which just didn't work.
There was a step towards it, but it didn't happen. But Martin, the bigger problem, I mean, it's very easy to rail against the system. What about the policies? What about the personalities? John McDonnell wrote just after the local elections in the Independent an article, "You can't expect people to vote for you in an election, but not tell them why." He's saying basically it's bereft of policies. There's no real direction in the Labour Party under Keir Starmer, and he's very, very nervous about even revealing what his policies might be. The idea is he's trying to sell this like Ariel or Daz washing powder, rather than what's he actually going to do.
Well, I think what's happening is that the right wing of the party, having had kittens during the Corbyn era, are now back to what they think they know how to do, which is win elections by swinging into the centre ground and being slightly Tory in order to win those marginal voters over that they need to win. But of course, they then lose, as we can see clearly in Bristol, they've lost the left wing of their party
to
the Green Party. Yeah. And of course, because there's a proportional system for the mayoral vote, that Sandy could have won. He didn't win, but he might have done, and they definitely have their sights on it next time,
I think. Anyway, before we get totally off the COVID, because we got into that political discussion there, I'd like to, just before we finish the first part, listen to this last Sunday's Steve Hilton on this Fox News program called The Next Revolution, which is I'm specifically asking you to consider this one, John, because we've been discussing this since January, when Steve Hilton first came out with all this stuff about the Wuhan lab being funded from the Pentagon and from Dr. Fauci, as to whether this was where the research, this very dangerous research which was being done in the United States, was moved to Wuhan, and somebody somewhere perhaps thought, oh well, maybe we could use this to pin a release of a nasty virus on the Chinese. So here is from a little extract from last Sunday's The Next Revolution with Steve Hilton on Fox News.
Since January, our special investigation into the origins of the pandemic has laid out in detail the public record of the specific projects through which the NIH did fund gain-of-function research in the Wuhan Institute of Virology. The fact that it's so easy to prove that what Dr. Fauci said there is a lie, just by looking at public documents on Dr. Fauci's own website, is what makes it a big lie, because it is so brazen, so audacious, yes, so impudent, that people might actually believe it. They might actually believe Fauci's boss, Dr. Francis Collins, who restated the big lie on Friday to our own Brett Baer.
Let me be very clear. We never approved any grant that would have supported gain-of-function research on dangerous coronaviruses to see if they could be more transmissible or lethal for individuals in the human species. That was not something that we would have done.
Really? Because in 2011, Dr. Collins, you were all for it. You co-wrote an article with Dr. Fauci literally saying that generating a potentially dangerous virus in the laboratory is a, quote, risk worth taking. That's why you funded it. This week, Fauci said that's entirely and completely incorrect. Okay then, here we go. In 2014, the NIAID initiated research project number R01AI110964, titled Understanding the Risk of Bat Coronavirus Emergence. By the way, we'll put out all the links to these documents. Just follow us at Steve Hilton X and at NextRev FNC. As part of that project, over $3 million was sent to a group called EcoHealth Alliance. And over $500,000 of that money was then sent to the Wuhan Institute of Virology. The requested work included this paragraph that many of our scientific sources told us was gain-of-function research. Now, Fauci can't deny the research project happened. We've just shown you the details. He's saying, yeah, but it wasn't gain-of-function. And yes, the label gain-of-function is subjective. But one of the world's leading experts on all this, Dr. Richard Ebright from Rutgers University, pointed us to the project's update in 2019 with this edition on screen now describing in vitro and in vivo infection experiments. Dr. Ebright said that this 2019 proposal unequivocally included gain-of-function research of concern. But our case doesn't even end there. We don't even need to use the gain-of-function label. We just need to look at what they actually did in Wuhan with Dr. Fauci's money, our money.
If you look at the grant and you look at the progress reports, it is not gain-of-function, despite the fact that people tweet that.
So do you still support...
Ah, look at the progress reports. Well, we did, especially this one. From 2017, co-authored by EcoHealth Alliance's Peter Daszak and the Wuhan Lab's Shi Zheng Li. It lists the ID from Dr. Fauci's NIAID in its funding section. This is the Fauci project. They analyzed bat coronaviruses and sequenced their genetic information. They then built various chimeras, genetically engineered new viruses, man-made in the lab. They infected human cells with them in the lab. And they then showed that their man-made viruses could replicate as a functional virus. There is no question, none, that Dr. Fauci and Dr. Collins did exactly what they advocated in that 2011 op-ed in the Washington Post. Through their commission to the Wuhan lab, they engineered a dangerous virus in the laboratory. All along, we've been careful in how we've presented the findings of our investigation. We've never suggested anyone created or released this virus intentionally as a bioweapon or anything else. We've never claimed definitively that this is the origin of the pandemic. We've said it seems to be the most likely origin. But Fauci's flat-out denial that he ever even funded this kind of research in Wuhan, a denial that is so easily proven to be false, really tells you something. Just look at the evidence piling up. The specific genetic experiments commissioned by Dr. Fauci, precisely described in a recent article by the former science editor of the New York Times, Nicholas Wade, carried out by a scientist with a history of conducting this type of research in labs with a level 2 safety rating when it should only be done at level 4. The fact that the outbreak began in Wuhan, 1,000 miles from where the bats who are the source of the virus live, but the one place in the world where its closest known genetic relative was sitting in a lab. Workers in that lab, where they were trying to make the virus more infectious, make it airborne so it could attack the human respiratory system. They came down with flu-like symptoms just before the outbreak was reported. Shi Zheng Li, who ran the lab and the Fauci experiments, her first reaction on hearing about the outbreak was that it was caused by a virus that escaped from her lab. And now, an outrageous denial of provable fact by Dr. Fauci and Dr. Collins. This pandemic has killed millions, devastated the world, and will have consequences that last for decades. As we've said from the start, we have to get to the bottom of it, not to point fingers, but to learn the lessons. Dr. Fauci's big lie this week should be a wake-up call to everyone. The media must stop treating Fauci as someone beyond accountability. After the exchange with Senator Paul, this was the level of scrutiny.
Can I just ask about you and Rand Paul? Does your body tense up every time? And by body, you know what I mean.
Yeah. You know, Gail, I just don't want to get into that tit for tat with him. I just don't understand what the problem is with him.
The media seems to be trapped in a cult of Fauci. What they lazily blow off as a conspiracy theory is now backed by a growing body of evidence, a growing number of scientists, the former director of the CDC. It's about the most important journalistic work there is. But still, no one, apart from us, it seems, is even trying to establish the facts. How else should we pursue accountability? Fauci lied to Congress. He wasn't under oath last week, so he should be brought back and put under oath and questioned again in more detail with more time for follow-up. And then Congress itself needs to commission a proper, independent, non-partisan investigation, science-driven, into the origins of the pandemic. They've just announced one on the Capitol riot, for goodness sake. The pandemic killed millions more, and yet there's no sign of an investigation into that. It is nuts. And then, if we can't get accountability, that way we need to use the law. If it turns out that this pandemic is the result of risky research commissioned by our own government that should have been flagged for review but wasn't, then surely everyone who suffered a loss has a civil case against Dr. Fauci's NIAID and Dr. Collins's NIH. If Fauci and Collins think their big lie this week is going to make all this go away, they are severely mistaken. It's done the exact opposite. It's shown us that we're really onto something. And we're not going to let up until we get the truth and the accountability that America deserves.
Martin, he doesn't think that this was released deliberately, but you do, I think. He's making it absolutely clear there that in order to try and cover his tracks, Fauci's picked a couple of specific lies that he thinks he can tell to divert attention away from this gain-of-function research he was funding.
Well, that's right. I mean, there are a number of levels of this, aren't there? I mean, Steve Hilton used to be Theresa May's
Cameron's advisor,
spin doctor, and then he's ended up working for Fox News.
He was one of the advisors to
the US.
David Cameron.
And, of course, Fox News is Murdoch. I'm not saying that that invalidates Steve Hilton's research here. But, of course, Murdoch has been pushing this line, and the right wing in the US and Australia have been pushing this line, that the Wuhan laboratory looks like it might well be the source of the infection. Now, they've been told to be quiet about that, so there's a bit of a tension going on within the establishment about whether they're going to run with this or not. Because, of course, the implication could well be that it's not accidental what's happened. And the reason that we've got a straw in the wind that suggests that possibility, which is that the Times of Israel reported that in November 2019, which was after the collapse of the banking system in September, the Israeli Defense Forces were told by the Defense Intelligence Agency of the United States of America that a pandemic was coming out of China, which implies that the Defense Intelligence Agency of the United States had foreknowledge of what was going to happen. Now, if you've got people inside the Wuhan laboratory, funded by the Pentagon, it wouldn't necessarily be that difficult for you to engineer a release from the laboratory. And there's another possibility of where it came from, which is the military games which were held in Wuhan in November, where 130 US military personnel were involved in those games. The other thing about Wuhan that you've got to remember is it's the centre of the Chinese transport system, and that the release or this was actually this was in Chinese New Year that this happened. So if it was some kind of an attack, then this would be the perfect opportunity to have it spread as rapidly as possible throughout the Chinese population. Now, in actual fact, that didn't happen like that because the Chinese took steps to prevent it. But you can see that these are very deep waters indeed. But of course, this is
it's not just in China, Martin. It's likely to spread all over the world from somewhere
like
that.
Well, indeed, and they're perfectly happy for it to do that.
There's a lot of evidence for the enormous problems with COVID in Italy, because there's a large Chinese population that was going backwards and forwards to Italy.
Well, that's because Italy is one of the countries in Europe that just signed up to the One Belt, One Road initiative. Yeah, so there's actually the textile industry in Italy, there's a lot of Chinese investment in it, so there's lots of people going backwards and forwards.
Anyway, I'd be fascinated to hear what you make of this, John, as a former medical professional, looking at the very idea of creating something like this in a laboratory. This gain-of-function research, which Obama banned and was then taken out of by Fauci, decided, well, we're going to do it anyway, we're just going to do it over in China instead.
Yeah, I mean, it's horrifying what is done in the name of sort of military intelligence, military weaponization.
Just to be absolutely clear, this is effectively military research being done under the cover of some sort of civilian.
That's right. They pretended it was civilian.
We're interested in bats.
There's lots of. We're interested in diseases, and we're interested in whether a disease will cause problems, and therefore of course you should research everything you can about it. But what was clearly happening is that. And you look at some of the patents that were being filed in the 1990s and early 2000s to sort of patent viruses, so that you could not only have the virus as your domain, but also the vaccines against the virus could be your domain. But the idea that this gain of function, particularly as certainly very early on, it was suggested that there were parts of the HIV virus in the COVID virus. There were 12 base pairs that came there, weren't in the original coronavirus. So it looked and literally looked very like this had been done. And the research that was being done in the States and then was banned in the States and then taken. It's either these are gain of function studies on the virus, or it's completely coincidental, and it seems so very unlikely that it's completely coincidental, with the bats being hundreds of miles away. They don't sell bats in the market. That was sort of one of the things. It's because they've got this fresh meat market and so on. The whole thing, it looks, and certainly Rand Paul's interrogation of Fauci, which was just forensic. I mean, it was just really clear that Rand Paul knew exactly what he was talking about. Just basically was floundering.
How come Fauci's still in his job?
Ooh.
Well, let's put it this way. Even if it's an accident, there's lots of people who want to cover it up. And if it's not an accident, then they're definitely determined to cover it up. And Fauci's been involved at the centre of all of this for years and years and years. So, obviously, he's potentially a protected person. But, of course, the heat is rising. And we shall see what happens as time goes on. As you know, you didn't interview him, but we took the interview from Russian TV. And it was a Russian intelligence colonel saying that we think that this is an attack on the Chinese. That's what he said.
Yeah.
And the Iranian Revolutionary Guard also said when this started, we think that this, because the spread of COVID in China, in Iran, was very focused on the military political leadership. And it was almost immediate. And they were very paranoid because Soleimani had just been assassinated.
If this is really what the Russians think, why aren't they saying this?
Because you don't necessarily, if you think somebody's doing something really nasty, you don't necessarily go, you're doing something really nasty, you just know about it. Don't let them know you know about it and work out what you're going to do about it, because that's the way it works.
Interesting. Okay, so...
Both parties can blame each other. You know, you've got American funding going into it, so the Americans can say, well, it's the Chinese who've done it, and the Chinese can say, well, it's the Americans who are doing things which we didn't do. So plausible deniability works both ways.
Well, I'm fascinated by one aspect of this, and that is the role of Murdoch. I mean, I've been sort of hardwired to hate Rupert Murdoch over the years as someone who's pretty much, driven a coach and horses through the British, previously respectable in some ways anyway, media, through the acquisition of The Sun, The Times, Sky and all this. And also, of course, his major role in the whopping, getting rid of the printing unions and, basically destroying the large parts of the trade union movement within the media. But suddenly we've got this situation where, Fox News, which is owned by him in the United States, is doing this stuff. And the thing is, it's actually quite brave about this, is they're not trying to blame the Chinese. They're saying, no, this could be a US operation going on in China. And I think it's largely because of this that it's been impossible, really, for the rest of the American media and the deep state to really pin it on the Chinese, because there are people out there who are making sure that everyone knows that if it's anything to do with this Wuhan unit, it could well be American money that's behind it all. Then we've also got in the UK here, we've got Talk Radio, which has been doing quite a good job. We had a clip from them earlier on talking about the use of fear and behavioural psychology, trying to basically treat the general public like lab rats and make them run in the little avenue that the government wants them to, or the pharmaceutical industry wants them to. And also Sky News Australia has been doing some really good stuff too. So they are also, but they're not, Sky here in the UK is not owned by Murdoch, but Sky Australia is owned by Murdoch. So I wonder if Rupert Murdoch is, you know, one of those people who's, he's getting towards the end of his life and he's thinking, well, if I've got this massive media empire, I'm not having this, you know, awful, evil, as we said earlier, thing, but fausted on humanity, and we're going to have at least a little bit of reasonable journalism. But you mentioned a group of doctors earlier, John. I found one this week. In fact, I was sent it by one of our correspondents. Thank you, whoever you were. Thanks very much. It's lovely when people do send stuff in. You can find my contact details on the show page at thisweek.org.uk. And a longer interview, full interview with Ron Humphreys too as well, the pub landlord from Bath on there. But we've got it's an organisation called HART, H-A-R-T. Nothing to do with Pat Hart, who booted us off the airwaves from Bristol Community Radio, chummy with Pally for many years with the Mayor Marvin Rees. The Health Advisory and Recovery Team, they're called. They publish COVID-19, an overview of the evidence, social and medical costs of lockdown. And they say that this must never be repeated, this lockdown. So they're basically with you on this, John. First of all, they say that we should reinstate the existing pro-2019 pandemic planning policies, which you were talking about earlier on, because, there's all sorts of changes with this COVID legislation. And they think that actually, you know, the previous legislation was much, much better and more reasoned. Secondly, they say we should stop mass testing of healthy people. Three, we should stop all mask mandates. Four, no vaccine certificates or child vaccinations whatsoever. So you shouldn't be able to get a sort of badge if you've had a vaccine and then do loads of stuff that other people can't do. They believe there should be a public education program on all of this. And plus a full public inquiry, Martin, something you've been talking about the way that COVID patients were put into hospitals and care homes. And seven and eight, funding for non-industry trials, which is what we've been hearing from Tess Laurie. She's getting, you know, almost tearful talking about, well, there's no money to do proper trials. Only the pharmaceutical industry can afford it. So what do you make of those, so what is it, eight demands there?
I support them. I think that they're a great organisation there. They're fairly quiet, but I know that some very eminent doctors and scientists and epidemiologists who are working particularly behind the scenes, because the ridicule and the opprobrium that piles on people who speak out is really damaging. You know, if you're a university professor and you speak out against it, not only does your department get damaged, but your whole university gets damaged. The funding, you know, it's being told, the vice chancellors are being told, if so and so doesn't stop saying what he's doing, we'll remove the funding from other areas.
Martin, these universities have changed, haven't they, over the last 30, 40 years, from being government-funded to industry-funded.
Yeah, and you can see, I mean, we've got David Miller up at Bristol University, who's basically been hounded out of his job as a sociology lecturer because of his views on Israel-Palestine. And you can imagine that if the university
he may not be handed out. The university may stick up for him.
Yeah, but at the same time, you can imagine some of the donors to the university. You know, you want a new library, you can keep David Miller, but you can whistle for your new library.
It's possible the bank's financing all the works that they're doing.
But universities are becoming businesses. And they always were to some extent, but it's become, you know, the model is the US, where it's basically for-profit education.
Finally, before we have some music, who's getting an ear bashing? Well, Martin Bashir, what would you like? Do you like to say anything about this, either of you, on the attacks that they've been on Martin Bashir? I mean, as I said at the beginning, at the top of the hour, it seems to me that this is just the latest chapter in Prince Charles' PR campaign, smearing his much-loved ex-wife and anyone who supported her. I mean, they're saying things like Prince William has said that Martin Bashir contributed to her death. There's also just a very basic question about whether this interview was obtained by deception. I don't know if you've been following it, but the 1995 BBC interview of Princess Diana, apparently the access to Princess Diana was gained by the interviewer, Martin Bashir, by the use of some faked statements. And they're making out that she didn't really want to do the interview, but he managed to wheedle his way into her household. Now, certainly the stuff I've seen, and in fact a documentary that went out last year, I think it was, says something completely different, that the Princess of Wales at the time embraced this opportunity as a wonderful chance to speak to the public, a bit like her secretly talking to the guy that wrote, I can't remember his name, Diana, her true story, Andrew Morton, that's right. So that she it was bottling a lot of stuff up, and she saw that this Panorama documentary was an opportunity to get it out of her system, and yet now we're being told, oh, this was a terrible, terrible thing to have done, they should never have broadcast this interview. Well, actually, I think it was a decent bit of investigative. And funnily enough, I was a few years after this up in the Director General's suite in Broadcasting House chatting with someone who was one of the chief, was on the executive board of the BBC, and he was saying, yeah, well, we took a lot of flack for that Diana interview, but we did the right thing. And the fact is, they, for example, they kept the fact that the interview was going out on Panorama away from anyone who's on the board of the BBC, because the chairman of the board was married to the Queen's chief lady in waiting. So they knew that if the board got to hear that this Diana interview was being made, they would all be shut down before it had a chance to go to air. Anyway, what do you make of this, Martin? Maybe you first on the Bashir. Well, everyone having a go at Bashir, and also saying that the interview traumatized Diana so much that it led to her fear and her paranoia, as Prince William has said.
Well, I'd make 2 points. The first point is that this is generally being used in the Tory press as another stick to beat the BBC with. So they're all piling in. Although in actual fact, the tabloid press is far more guilty of spreading rumours about Princess Diana and selling copy, of course, on the back of it. I mean, lots of journalists, you know, the Daily Mirror journalist who went down because she used to come to a gym, which was just behind where I lived in Fulham. And they secretly got into the gym and photographed her on the gym equipment with her legs open. Yeah, that's the sort of standard of journalism that they went for. And I think the first thing she was an adult and she chose to give that interview. The idea that there was some kind of manipulation involved, and otherwise she wouldn't have said all this stuff, is basically, you know, she wanted to say these things. It's pretty clear. She was unhappy and upset, and of course it ruffled loads of feathers and all the rest of it. And so those are the 2 points I'd make, really, is that an awful lot of this is flim-flam.
I don't really have a view on it. I obviously don't know what the circumstances were. I know that it was a very powerful interview at the time. And certainly, I mean, I've been watching The Crown on Netflix, which has had
that's not real, you know.
I know it's not real, but it just gives an idea of the sort of lives these people lead. And it is just so, so different from the lives that we lead, but just particularly the episodes with Diana and the pressure that was put on her and her husband and the relationships and the different stresses that they were facing. And I imagine that she had a pretty wretched life. She married very young. I think she was, in her late teens. Married a man that she thought was the most amazing man ever. What everybody was regarding as a fairy tale princess wedding, and life did not pan out that way.
Well,
for
I mean,
her.
She talked about it.
She wanted to talk about it.
It seems pretty obvious that Prince Charles did not love her, and obviously that's a bit devastating for someone who's a virgin and marrying, somebody at a very, who's much older than her, a very, very young age. But this, I think, there's an attempt here, I think, to sort of spin this whole thing as, oh, what a terrible interview. One of the things I heard was that, I think it was a brilliant interview, an absolutely superb piece of journalism. And, one of the things that's been being talked about is that the BBC will never, ever air this interview. promise they'll never air the interview again. So we're going to air the interview tonight, of course, a little bit of it. But one of the things Princess, I mean, we're here, I'm going to put that on at the very end of the programme, but one of the things she talks about is, you know, that the way the press harassed her, and that became absolutely obsessive, and that, you know, she was saying that, well, it wasn't just that when she turned up at an event, the press were there. As soon as she stepped out the door, the press were there. And they say, well, you sell newspapers, Diana, and you know, and you're that's why we're here. It's because people want to see, they want to know you, they want to know what you're doing. And so the press were actually kind of doing their job, although she obviously took quite a lot of measures to make sure that she had to keep people away, or to keep them away. But then, of course, they would take their photographs anyway. So we'll be hearing that interview at the end. But it's time now for a bit of music and a bit of a break, because we're going to have to curtail. We've been going on and on about COVID with this fascinating guest here, Dr. John Rogers. And so I think it's about time we had a bit of a musical break. Before we do that, let's say thank you to Dr. John Rogers, who's very kindly popped in today. He was only going to be here for an hour, but you've been here for, what, 2.5, I think, actually. Sorry, John. this show is repeated at 11 p.m. on Fridays, at 11 and 5 and a.m. and p.m. all week on the PRSC stream. And that is when the Richie Allen Show isn't streaming live, as we're now streaming live, with Richie's permission, the Richie Allen Show live on the PRSC stream. And that is, I believe it's Monday to Thursday at 5 o'clock. From 5 till 7 p.m. and Sundays from 10 till 11 a.m. And you can hear us over Sunday lunch at camberleysradioquk.com. My first book, released as an e-book during the November's Halloween lockdown, is now out in paperback. It's called The Traitors of Arnhem, and it connects the dots between the disastrous World War II battle featured in the Joseph E. Levine film, A Bridge Too Far, to the creation and the funding of a Fourth Reich by Hitler and Churchill's private secretaries. Collusion before the end of the war, right the way through to the political arm of NATO at the Bilderberg conferences, chaired for the first two decades by former SS officer and Nazi spy Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands. So the book, The Traitors of Arnhem, paperback is £15, including postage here in the UK. I'm hoping to be able to send it outside the UK soon. But let's have some music now. Thanks again to Dr. John Rogers, our guest in the first hour. We're back with Martin in a minute as we take our weekly look around the world.
Oh, dot. And a little bit of water goes a long way, 'cause it's hot. Three good buddies were laughing and smoking in the back of a rented Ford. They couldn't know they weren't going far. Each one with the money. Truck, and they hadn't seen a cop around all day. They brought everything they needed, bags and scales to weigh the stuff. The driver said the border's just over the bluff.
From 1972, the Blue Oyster Cult from their original album, The Last Days of May. Gorgeous song. You never hear that anywhere. I hardly ever hear it. Of course, the reason I'm playing it is because it is the last days of May. We're coming into that now. And what else is it that happens in the last days of May, Martin? Bilderberg.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Bilderberg. Just in the last days of May. And so the... I thought we'd start tonight just with a brief look at the Bilderbergers. Very bizarre. I mean, what do you make of their complete disappearance, Martin, this year? Last year they said they announced that they were going to have a... are you all right there?
Yes, I'm listening.
You're going to have a year off this year? Nothing.
Well, it may be that the efforts of people like yourself to expose them and make them, you know, make them more transparent have led them to conclude that it's not worth having it anymore. I don't know.
So, okay, so there's another, I think, far, 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 if I can say far 10 times, more likely is that they are meeting, but they just make, that we was always very much touch and go as to whether we would be able to discover where they were meeting anyway.
Well, indeed. So at one stage, they pretended they didn't exist. So anybody who said that there was a Bilderberg group was poo-pooed as a conspiracy theorist. Then eventually you bought their domain name so that anybody looking up
Excuse
Bilderberg...
Excuse me, no, I would totally deny that. I bought my domain name.
You're right, yes, but as far as they were concerned, it was there. But they didn't even bother to have a domain name because they were that secret. Now, what's happened subsequently is as publicity about them has gradually increased, I think the usefulness of the meeting... to those who plan those meetings is probably, largely reduced. So it may well be that instead of having a Bilderberg group, it's just the CIA, for example, is now splintered into all sorts of different organisations. It's not just the CIA. You've got all of these private sector companies that subcontract to them, etc. So what will have happened to Bilderberg is that the things that used to be done at Bilderberg are now being done elsewhere under another name.
I don't agree again. I think you've got a concept of a conference that is quite possibly still meeting in order to recruit potential new politicians that then appear just to get elected because we've elected them. So they're making sure basically they're covering as many bases as possible, that all of the major candidates standing in the NATO countries are their creatures.
Well, that was the norm before. As you know, that's what Bilderberg was all about. It's like a horse fair where politicians, the real big movers and shakers get to look at the politicians, look at their fetlocks, look at their teeth, decide if they want to buy them. But the Davos meeting didn't take place because of the COVID crisis, etc. So it may just be straightforward that, because of COVID, they don't want to drag everybody off to a meeting. Or it may be that they are meeting secretly, as they used to do,
So there are various attempts to say that the Bilderberg meeting may be taking place here or there, but certainly nothing credible. What about this idea of the Fascist International meeting in Montreux? This is the last place the Bilderberg met 2 years ago.
Well, I mean, there may be continuity. As you know, the Bilderberg Group was named after the Bilderberg Hotel, which was in Oosterbeek, which was part of the Kessel inside the Arnhem. And it may well be, as your book argues, that they met there because it's going back to the scene of the crime, getting everybody's hands dirty, making sure that they all know where they're coming from. That could be the case, or it could just be, Montreux and places like that are places where people have conferences because they are, the sort of places that wealthy people go to have conferences.
It was quite an important conference, though, the 1934 Montreux Fascist Conference. It was just as the fascist movements were really picking up in across Europe, particularly Italy and Germany.
Yes, and there may be some continuity there, or it may just be that this is the sort of place that anybody who's having a conference. This is the sort of place they have conferences.
Yeah, so they actually called themselves the CAUR, which I'm not sure what it stood for, founded by Benito Mussolini, and their job was to act as a fascist international. Now, we often think of fascists as being nationalists, Martin, but these people were clearly working across many different countries in together.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's one of the problems for the far right in general, is that they are nationalist in their orientation, so that in actual fact, the far right in Romania, for example, hate the far right in Hungary, and the far right in Hungary hate the far right in Romania.
So these conferences must be rather...
They can be very fraught.
Yes.
I mean, the problem on the left is that we're all supposed to be on the same side, but it turns out we're scratching each other's eyes out.
Well, the left are exactly...
But
the fascists
are supposed to hate each other in the first place, so they find it quite difficult to align their politics. Although, if you see what's happened over the Gaza stuff, the only European country which hasn't called for a ceasefire on the Israelis is the Hungarians. And the Hungarian regime is pretty anti-Semitic. It's quite part of Hungarian right-wing culture. But they're also pro-Israel, and that's a shift that's been taking place in recent times. In the 1930s, they were anti-Semites, but today they're pro-Israeli government.
Okay, so what do you make of the developments over there with the ceasefire particularly? I've got some clips here. We're going to hear in a second from the Israeli, I think he's Defence Minister, Benny Gantz, but he's certainly, basically a soldier. Although I think most of the Israeli leadership seem to have cut their teeth in special forces,
etc. Everybody in Israel used to have to serve in the military anyway. Apart from the
the
Orthodox
special forces seem to work their way into government.
Yeah, absolutely, but I mean that's what you know. George W. Bush used to head up the CIA. You know, I mean, there's clearly an overlap, especially in a sort of militarized state like Israel. Well, I think the ceasefire, both sides realized that they can't carry on because of the pressures that are, that they're under to call it off. Because the danger is, if it carries on any further, is that they're going to spark, from the Israeli point of view, they're going to spark an intifada, not just in the occupied West Bank, where scores of people have been shot dead in the last couple of weeks. Not as many as in Gaza, but quite a lot of people. And also within Israel itself, where a situation is developing a bit like Northern Ireland in 1969, where you've got right-wing mobs rampaging and lynching Arabs with the support of the police, and the Arabs basically fighting back. And that could easily plunge the whole country into chaos pretty damn quickly.
Anyway, so the Benny Gantz, who was vying with Netanyahu for leadership in Israel, as he is now a defence minister, he had this to say about Hamas stopping terrorising his people.
5 days ago, after Hamas yet again fired hundreds of rockets into our civilian population, I directed the IDF to launch Operation Guardian of the Walls, a major military campaign to strike at the terror infrastructure in Gaza that is threatening the safety of our people and our region. This was not a question of choice. It was a question of duty. Duty to our citizens, duty to democracy, and duty to the values of life, freedom, and the rule of law. No country, institution, or international body can question our right to protect our citizens and our sovereignty. I call upon Hamas, stop terrorizing our people and stop terrorizing yours. It is absurd that we do everything in our power to avoid hitting your civilians while you proudly hide behind them. And I call upon every world leader who values life and liberty to take a clear stand against this horrific violence and stand up loudly and clearly for Israel's right to defend itself. I also thank our partners across the globe for denouncing Hamas terror and extremism and supporting the Israeli people's aspiration to live free of fear. I pray for those who lost their loved ones and hope that we will soon be able to restore stability and promote quiet in Israel and throughout the region.
Okay, so that's Israeli Benny Gantz there. He's really painting a picture of the Hamas as using the civilian population as human shields, Martin.
Well, I mean, there's not much else they can do. I mean, Hamas, Gaza is the most crowded place on earth. There's 2 million people crammed in there. So if anybody fires anything out of that enclave into the Israeli state, then, you know, they're going to be surrounded by civilians inevitably. And of course, the same is true of the Israelis. I mean, what's missing from all of this is who's got a right in international law to be there. Don't forget, many of the people inside Gaza can actually see the farms and villages where they used to live before they were crammed into Gaza. And in actual fact, in international law, after the Blitz attacked Britain, and you know, over 1,000 people were killed in Bristol, for example, during the Blitz. We didn't give up. In actual fact, what we did is we gave it back to the Germans in spades, and we incinerated hundreds of thousands of people in Dresden. Nobody was prosecuted for that because it's not a crime in international law. Same goes for Hamas. They've only killed however many people it is. It's a blip.
Well, these figures are very important, aren't they? Because I get really rather annoyed when I'm listening to the news bulletins, and we've got the National Union of Journalists conference going on this weekend online only. I was even trying to connect up with it earlier on. I couldn't manage to connect. This basic journalistic standards, that all they're saying is, oh, so many people died. Well, that's one way you can put it. But then if you really wanted to, you could explain to the viewers and the listeners who has died or how many people on each side have died, this sort of thing. And this is, it seems to me, a pretty shoddy tactic, which is being used generally now to... I think the total is about 260 people dead, and on the Israeli side, that's 12 people dead, 2 Israeli children, 60 Palestinian children. But they don't explain the difference. So this is clearly, as we were saying last week, there's a very important kill ratio factor here, with the Israelis killing, well, in that particular case, where we're talking about something like 20 times more Palestinians than the other way around.
Yes, and as I say, in international law, you're not supposed to target civilian populations. But on the other hand, the Israelis, I mean, what sparked this off is the continued ethnic cleansing within Jerusalem, which in international law doesn't belong to the Israelis at all. They took it in an armed way in 1967. When Serbia tried to do things like that in the 1990s, we went to war with Serbia, and the Royal Air Force bombed Serbia for 78 days and killed loads more children than have been killed by Hamas. When are the RAF going to go to the International Criminal Court for that?
So
they're not.
What do you make of the targeting of the Al Jazeera and Associated Press? Tim Llewellyn, who I'm in touch with, he's a former BBC correspondent. He made the point, well, the main news agency in the United States has just been blown to pieces by the Israelis. Does the president have nothing to say about this?
Well, it's obvious why they did it, is because they don't want reports coming out from inside Gaza showing things as even previous attacks of, you know, showers of white phosphorus and so on.
Isn't this also gangster intimidation tactics as well?
Well, of course it is. I mean, that's what it is. I mean, that, you know, you've got to remember that the people in Gaza have elected Hamas to be their leaders, just as we elected, you know, the coalition government to fight Hitler in the 40s. And under those circumstances, it's only for the people and their elected representatives to decide how much punishment we can take and how much we're prepared to try and dish out to the other side. There was no holes barred in warfare, I'm afraid. There should be, but there aren't. And ultimately, the Israelis
aren't there, because they haven't nuked the West Bank or Gaza yet.
Well, if they did,
so far
that,
as we know.
Well, I mean, this is one of the problems of the Israelis' possession of nuclear weapons. They cannot use them on the Palestinians without destroying themselves. So the only legitimate, they're probably there as the Martin von Krevelt, the Israeli defense academic, said, we can use our nuclear weapons to nuke Rome, London, Berlin.
Yeah.
So if the Europeans really start to push us to compromise, we can threaten them.
There is an aspect to all of this, though, that, you know, it's never ever analysed, is that the Israeli government wants a conflict. They actually want this conflict because they know that by creating a war, it's going to drag the Americans in on their behalf.
That's right. And, of course, it's their decisions to annex Jerusalem, supported by the Americans, to evict the existing Arab population from East Jerusalem. This is ethnic cleansing, and of course it's violent ethnic cleansing. They then attack the Al-Aqsa Mosque on Ramadan with tear gas and rubber bullets. And Hamas, don't forget there was going to be an election in Palestine, and Hamas are trying to compete with Fatah to be the leaders of the Palestinian Authority. It's been cancelled now, but Hamas will be trying to convince people that they should be the leaders and they know what to do. And of course, one of the things that's happened is that the rockets that Hamas have been firing are more dangerous than they have been previously. So what they're trying to do is get the Israelis to understand is, you are going to suffer too. If you kill our children, we are going to try and kill yours.
Yeah, but I mean, the Israelis are trying to provoke them, and yes, of course they're being provoked, yes, which is not necessarily the right tactic.
Well, some would say that's the wrong tactics, but they would say this is a price we're prepared to pay in order to try and move things along. And ultimately, of course, I've been reading the discussions about the discussions between Hamas and Hezbollah. Now, Hezbollah and Hamas have a complicated relationship, because Hezbollah is largely Shia and Hamas is largely Sunni. And during the Syrian civil war, Hamas were aligned with the anti-Assad forces, which generally pissed off the regime in Damascus, because for many years they had provided support to Hamas. and they felt let down by that. But what's subsequently happened is that the Hamas and Hezbollah have come into alignment, and Hezbollah were basically saying to Hamas, do you want us to join in? Because we can really hit the Israelis. We've got very accurate rockets, and we could actually hit their military.
Well, maybe what I'm trying to point out here is maybe that's what the Israelis want.
Not necessarily. I think what the reason why they've called
the ceasefire... They want to escalate, Martin, surely they do.
They want to escalate in terms of attacking Iran. And they want the Americans to do that as well, because if they have to fight on their own against Iran, the Hezbollah are going to devastate Israel.
So that chappy we just heard from, Benny Gantz, he is a retired army general serving as the alternate prime minister. So he's actually he's a sort of alternative to Netanyahu now.
Yes, and so Netanyahu has got more of an interest in escalating, because he could be removed from power, but this crisis cements him in power. Now, you could argue that it is internal Israeli politics that have led to this conflict, but at the same time, the Palestinians have got their own perspective. They have basically reached the point where they are fed up with being told that they've just got to shut up and put up.
I think some of the Western press seem to have been doing some reasonable coverage of this. In other words, some of both sides, including the Palestinians, the poor Palestinian side, being covered reasonably well, because they realise just how serious this is, and it could trigger a world war.
Well,
and Russia already.
Well, that's
there.
Right, because if Hezbollah join in, then the Israelis will try and attack Hezbollah. Then the Syrian army joins in on the side of Hezbollah. Then the Americans join in on the side of the Syrians, and the Russians join on the side of the Israelis, and the Russians join in on the side of the Syrians. During the Cold War, both sides knew that there was a real danger for something like that to happen. But there's now, you know, after all the suffering that has been in Syria,
well, all the treaties have been torn up, haven't they?
Yes, that's right. I mean, ultimately, war happens because the people that you're up against are not prepared to accept your reasonable demand.
Potentially a war agenda here. That there are some people out there, yeah, who say, well, we dare, and who dares wins. Anyway, one of the more positive comments came from Saeed Avazi, who used to be chairman of the Conservative Party. Baroness Vazi, in the House of Lords, gave a speech about this earlier on this week, which I haven't really heard anywhere else, but here she is.
In the most gracious speech, Her Majesty said, "My government will uphold human rights and democracy across the world. I will address that in the context of Israel and Palestine, an issue upon which I resigned from cabinet nearly 7 years ago. I saw then at the heart of government what we see now, our government simply failing to implement its own stated policy. My lords, we have a policy. We have a policy of a two-state solution, but we do not recognize Palestine as a state. Ministers refuse to even use its name. We have a policy of a peace process, but we have no appetite to initiate or prioritize one. We have a policy that settlement building is illegal and contrary to international law, yet there is no consequence where every year more and more settlers, supported by the Israeli government and diaspora groups, occupy more land in Palestine. We do nothing to deter Israel from expanding settlements, forced evictions, and home demolitions. This is ethnic cleansing and is denying the reality of the state of Palestine to even exist. Our policy is that East Jerusalem is an integral part of a future Palestinian state, and yet we do nothing as extremists barge into homes, terrorizing Palestinian families who've lived there for generations. Our policy is to defend human rights, but no action follows as hundreds of Palestinian children every year are arrested, mistreated, and incarcerated. Our policy is supporting international accountability and funding the International Criminal Court, but we oppose the ICC's investigation into war crimes in Palestine. Each time, my lords, we fail to implement our own policy, we send out the message to an ever-extremist right-wing Israeli government that there will be no cost or consequences for its treatment of the Palestinians. This total impunity is feeding Israel's prolific rise in far-right extremism, leaving a society fighting for its very soul.
Martin, don't you wish there were some Labour politicians who could deliver speeches like that?
Well, I think that Jeremy Corbyn made a very similar speech to the protest last
whole,
week.
This whole sentiment has now been banished from the Labour Party.
It hasn't been banished. It's that there is a conflict about it. Don't forget that Baroness Worsley is a Conservative, but she's basically marginalised within her own party. So it isn't. The problem is that the Israeli state is far too powerful.
Where are the Labour voices like that?
Well, I think
this is traditional Labour territory, isn't it?
Well, it is, and you will find that various Labour MPs, including Zayed Sultana, was also speaking last Saturday, it's becoming
Zara Sultana, who is the MP Labour MP for Coventry.
Yeah, I think this is. The fact that Starmer has been so mealy-mouthed over all these things, shows the difference between him and the Labour grassroots and the Corbyn faction of the party.
But this whole thing about anti-Semitism, I think, is fascinating, and the way that this is used as a tactic in the media in order to try and shut down discussion about Israel. It's basically like the home front. I mean, I was thinking about the traveller evictions being the home front here in Bristol. They had a big Palestinian flag outside their site, which was evicted yesterday morning. But also, the other thing that's going on the home front is that the journalists are being silenced. And here is a little clip of it's three different individuals all talking about the same topic, which is the use of anti-Semitism to shut down discussion and debate, basically the fake use of the anti-Semitism smears, which is an appalling thing to be doing. It just trivialises the whole suffering of the Jews in the Second World War. And we're going to hear three people. First of all, Viktor Ostrovsky, who's a former Mossad agent, talking about the way that he used to do this to people. Then we're going to hear Shulamit Aloni, who's a former education minister in Israel, talking about exactly the same thing to Amy Goodman on Democracy Now. And then finally, I suppose, to top it all off is the Israeli Jewish writer Norman Finkelstein, talking about the way he despises these anti-Semitism smears.
I had a record with my second book. I think my first book sold something around the world, close to 8 million copies. My second book was not reviewed in any newspaper in North America. Now that's a record. No, I'm sorry. I think the guy in the Phoenix Gazette and the people from B'nai B'rith walked in and asked for him to resign. Yeah, because he's an anti-Semite. Now, I know what they do because I used to ask them to do it. I mean, when I was in the Mossad and we had a guy that gave us problems in the U.S. and he was speaking out and he was talking like Pete talked once and said, Israel is bombing Lebanon with cluster bombs. We say, hey, who's that guy? You know? Pete McCarthy, we used to call him. Yeah. Which is Pete the Cockroach. Because he makes a lot of noise and you can't get rid of him. So what you do is you get in touch with a guy in the station in New York or in the station in Washington. You say, tell the guys at B'nai B'rith to label him. And of course the campaign starts and before you know it, the guy's labeled. And he's an anti-Semite. Because that's what we say he is. And that's one stain you cannot wash. Now, it shames me as a Jew to tell you that. But that's the fact. And it's wrong.
Often when there is dissent expressed in the United States against policies of the Israeli government, people here are called anti-Semitic. What is your response to that as an Israeli Jew?
Well, it's a trick. We always use it. When from Europe somebody is criticizing Israel, then we bring up the Holocaust. When in this country people are criticizing Israel, then they are anti-Semitic. And the organization is strong and has a lot of money. And the ties between Israel and the American Jewish establishment are very strong, and they are strong in this country. As you know, they have power, which it's okay. They are talented people, and they have power, money, and media, and other things. And their attitude is Israel, my country, right or wrong, the identification. and they are not ready to hear criticism. And it's very easy to blame people who criticize certain acts of the Israeli government as anti-Semitic and to bring up the Holocaust and the suffering of the Jewish people. And that justifies everything we do to the Palestinians.
I don't like to play before an audience the Holocaust card. But since now I feel compelled to, my late father was in Auschwitz. My late mother, please shut up. My late father was in Auschwitz. My late mother was in Maidanek concentration camp. Every single member of my family on my father's side,
the Jews did not take arms against the Germans.
My late father was in Auschwitz concentration camp. My late mother was in Maidanek concentration camp. Every single member of my family on both sides was exterminated. Both of my parents were in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. And it's precisely and exactly because of the lessons my parents taught me and my two siblings that I will not be silent when Israel commits its crimes against the Palestinians. And I consider nothing more despicable than to use their suffering and their martyrdom to try to justify the torture, the brutalization, the demolition of homes that Israel daily commits against the Palestinians. So I refuse any longer to be intimidated or browbeaten by the tears. If you had any heart in you, you would be crying for the Palestinians, not for what she's done.
Okay, that's Norman Finkelstein there, author of The Holocaust Industry, an absolutely fascinating book, which I read about, must be 20 years ago now, about the idea that, you know, you can actually produce fake versions of, suffering of the Holocaust in order to try and get people to believe more in it or make it seem worse than it actually was. Of course, it was absolutely horrific, but he pointed out that quite a lot of the Holocaust accounts, obviously to do with the Jewish people, were fabricated in one way or another. So a fascinating guy, Norman Finkelstein, and an absolutely forensic in his criticism of the Israeli state, Martin.
Yeah, I mean, he told it like it was, didn't he? I think Holocaust denial is, reprehensible. Anybody who pretends that nothing happened is completely off the wall. But on the other hand, does that justify ethnic cleansing of Palestinians, shooting of children by Israeli soldiers, stealing the land of another people? The answer is no, it doesn't. Not in traditional Judaic teaching or in modern solidaristic understanding of human rights. All wrong.
So whereabouts do we find good criticism of this? I would suggest most of the main BBC television news is a complete waste of time. I mean, occasionally they'll have. Sometimes Sky will have some reasonably decent report. And the Today programming, not very good. You know, anyway, one of my choices for the conflicts like this is The World Tonight on BBC Radio 4, where in the evenings they quite often have a little bit more in-depth and fair broadcasts from both sides. And last night that was a case where we had Danny Damon, who's the Israeli ex-UN ambassador, speaking, and also Dr. Basim Nahim from Hamas speaking about this announcement, or just about to announce a ceasefire there. But anyway, here's let's have a couple of clips, one from each. And so we're here from Danny Danon, ex-UN ambassador to Israel on The World Tonight.
We wanted to achieve one simple thing from the beginning, a peaceful environment for our citizens. That was the goal of the operation, to restore peace in our region. And we had no choice. we were dragged into this cycle. And I believe that we also restored the deterrence with Hamas. And I hope that until the next cycle, we'll be able to live in peace for at least a few good years.
When you say the next cycle, when do you expect that?
So I hope it will be longer than the one we saw 7 years ago. So we don't have any control of that. It's Hamas who decide about it. And unfortunately, from our experience, they will continue to take the funds from the international community to dig tunnels and to build rockets instead of investing it in the infrastructure and the people in Gaza. It is a terror organization, and that's what they care about, terrorizing Israel like they did in the last 11 days. But they learned the lesson, and I hope that they will think twice before targeting us again.
Well, that is the Israeli point of view about this. But, of course, Hamas were responding to Israel's attempt to ethnically cleanse Palestinians in Jerusalem.
The international community giving funds for the Hamas to dig tunnels and to build rockets?
Well, the international community...
And that's why they're trying to cut off aid to the Palestinians, because it's being misused.
What's interesting in this, fascinating in this, is Gaza is besieged not just by the Israelis, but also by the Egyptians. So they have sealed the border on the other side, and they keep it sealed. That is because the Egyptian military government is supported by the West. If there was an elected government in Egypt, Mohamed Morsi, of course, died in prison, they would basically be able to supply Hamas with any kind of weaponry they wanted. And therefore, it would suddenly be a situation where Hamas would have the sufficient weaponry to face off properly with the Israeli armed forces. That isn't the case, because there was a military coup in Egypt supported by the West, including Britain, which put Sisi in power. And they sealed the border from the other side. So Hamas, in actual fact, and the people in Gaza are completely surrounded. That could change. If there was an uprising in Egypt, most people in Egypt support Hamas.
Well, there was. It was called the Arab Spring. That's all been put. Yeah, and in fact, almost right. All the leaders of that were killed afterwards, weren't they, by the new government, the Sisi government, when they came in.
That's right. They killed hundreds
so
of people.
They identified a whole load of people who were political activists in Egypt. And then once the democratic election had been overthrown by the military junta supported by the United States, many of those Muslim Brotherhood activists were put in jail, but many were executed.
That's right. So there's another. So
you've completely got rid of a political movement there.
Yeah. Well. Yeah. So in other words, this isn't just about Gaza. It isn't just about Israel. It's about imperialism, which has been going on since. The West took over the Middle East at the end of the First World War and started to impose their will on the locals.
So I think the Middle East is... Why is it the Middle East always, Martin, that seems to be so focused? I mean, I know it's the place where Asia, Europe and Africa meet, but it's also got this religious significance. Why do you think there's so much focus on the Middle East?
Well, it's partly to do with what people are interested in. There's lots of nasty stuff going on in the world, but we don't necessarily hear about it because it's not at the top of our agenda. The Middle East is at the top of the agenda because it threatens people in Europe, for example. What happened in Libya when we overthrew the Gaddafi government was that we opened the floodgates, for example, to thousands of refugees from the war in Iraq to enter the European Union. And, of course, that means that people, you're going to have to deal with it. That is why it's important. And, that's one of the reasons why it's important. You've got the historical, the three Abrahamic faiths are based there, and they have millions of adherents all over the world. And the other obvious thing to talk about is oil and things and natural resources.
Yep. Okay. So the final clip then is, also from the World Tonight last night, but this is the other side. This is the Dr. Bassem Naim from Hamas giving his point of view about what he's as usual, and of course as we are doing, is criticising quite a lot the Western media, which seems to be generally speaking, do things like, for example, they say Israel says is the beginning line of the news bulletin. Well, you know, that's obviously, that's only coming from one point of view. So let's have a listen to Hamas now, this so-called hang on, before we hear this, Martin, we keep hearing about Hamas as a terrorist organisation. Is the Israeli state a terrorist organisation?
Well, the Israeli state was set up by the Irgun and the Haganah, the Stern Gang, all of which were classified by the British as terrorists at the time, and Hamas's internal structures are modelled on their enemies, just as the IRA modelled its internal structure on
That's
the British
amazing,
Army.
Isn't it? I just find it incredible how what Viktor Ostrovsky, Shulamit Aloni and Norman Finkelstein are saying there about anti-Semitism smears can keep so much of the press, and of course there's financial interest as well, I'm sure, you know, on Israel's side in all of this, which is incredible since you've got an army and an air force facing a civilian population without an army or an air force.
Yeah, well, I think one of the other things that happens is the Israelis do have foreign travel, unlike the poor old people in Gaza, and they're so like us. They look like us. They go to the shops like us. They have foreign holidays and credit cards. They're people like us. And Hamas, well, they're just untermensch, aren't they?
Okay, let's have a listen to Hamas's Dr. Bassem Naim speaking on The World Tonight last night.
Unfortunately, this question I have received repeatedly from the Western media because they insist to adopt the Israeli narrative. The story didn't start by launching rockets from Hamas. The story started, first of all, by the occupation for more than 50 years, and by 15 years of siege, and lastly, by the continuous aggression against our people in Sheikh Jarrah and in Al-Aqsa Mosque. And we have appealed all the international community to intervene to stop this continuous aggression. What was the result? Nothing. The root of this problem is the occupation. As long as this root, the political root of this problem is not handled, is not dealt with, you cannot depend on fragile ceasefire. Calm, it doesn't cease. Without justice, without implementing the international resolution and giving the Palestinians their rights of freedom and dignity and independent sovereign state, you cannot expect long-term calm.
Well, I mean, he's making the fundamental point. If Britain had been occupied by a foreign power, I'm quite sure that Boris Johnson and the Daily Telegraph and the Spectator would be perfectly behind armed resistance to that foreign power. The Palestinians are told, yes, but your armed resistance is futile. You can never win against the Israelis. They're much better armed than you. And therefore, you should just accept what is actually wrong, which we accept in our, you know, in a sort of shamefaced way. We accept that you've been wronged here. But, you know, on balance, your best bet is to just knuckle under. Now, in actual fact, there is nothing in international law. A foreign occupying army can be resisted. All the settlements in the West Bank are justified legally by the Israeli courts on the basis that they are a military necessity. We need to have settlements in the West Bank on the high ground as for military reasons. That's the reason they justify them. But that means that they are military targets. Everybody in those settlements, by international standards, in international law, if the Israelis say that we have to have settlements for military reasons, they are military bases and therefore absolutely attackable in international law. You can't take people to the International Criminal Court for attacking them.
Well, the International Criminal Court is really rather useless anyway, isn't it?
Yeah, but at the same time, they've started to talk about taking the Israelis.
I mean, they just seem to go for African leaders, well, and Bush and Blair.
There's some discussion that they may start talking about the Israelis going to the International Criminal Court, and the British government is backing the Israeli government's position that this is anti-Semitic.
Oh, dear.
Extraordinary.
Well, this is the sort of thing Baroness Velsey was excellently pointing out earlier. Well, looking at the latest situation over there. Now, God, you do wonder, don't you? Al-Aqsa Mosque, the Israeli police today have stormed the complex following the ceasefire. So one does wonder whether the Israelis are trying to get it all going again. Tear gas, stun grenades and rubber-coated bullets steel bullets, which was missed out in that report from Middle East Eye, fired at worshippers. So the Israeli security forces have fired tear gas, stun grenades and rubber bullets at worshippers inside the Al-Aqsa Mosque hours after thousands gathered at the holy site to celebrate the announcement of a ceasefire. Footage released on social media shows Israeli police firing into crowds of Palestinian worshippers shortly after they congregated for Friday prayers. It doesn't sound to me as if the Israeli Defence Forces really want this ceasefire at all, Martin.
Well, they want the ceasefire with Hamas so that they can then deal with the internal opposition within Jerusalem, the West Bank and Israel proper. And tomorrow in Bristol, there is a protest march about all of this, assembling at the Shah Jalal Mosque in Easton under the M32 at 2 p.m. I imagine I shall be going to that. People, just because there's been a ceasefire in Gaza doesn't mean that this uprising is over. This uprising is just beginning. Hamas have agreed to a ceasefire, but that doesn't mean that the Palestinians in Jerusalem or the West Bank or Israel proper are going to give up now. They're about to have another intifada, and loads of people are going to die, and the Israelis are going to have to defend themselves.
Israeli police spokesman Mickey Rosenfeld said officers had been targeted by Palestinians who threw stones and tried to suppress... began riot suppression measures. So if these Palestinians had not thrown stones at the army, then they're saying that they wouldn't have gone in to the mosque.
Yeah, but the point is that the Palestinians, because of the annexation of Jerusalem, they are absolutely within their rights to use any weapons to hand to resist the occupying forces. You might argue that it's futile and they go, this is going to loads of them are going to die, it's not going to achieve anything, but there is no legal reason in international law why they cannot throw a rock at the head of a soldier holding a gun. And the soldier may shoot back, but he's in the wrong.
Iranians, meanwhile, are saying that Biden has agreed to lift major sanctions. So this is there's going to be an extension of the nuclear monitoring deal with Iran, apparently, according to the International Atomic Energy Authority. But Biden wants these sanctions lifted now.
Well, it's interesting to see that these are straws in the wind, because the other thing that's happening, which I was talking about on RT this week, is that Biden is going to apparently going to meet with Putin, and they've also decided that they're not going to put sanctions on certain companies which are completing the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. Now, it may
be... So that means the Americans have finally caved into the Nord Stream, realised that this is happening.
Yeah, that's what it looks like. But it may well be that the Biden administration is trying to wring the changes from the Trump administration, and an obvious thing they should do is de-recognise Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. They're the only country that does so. The European states, including Britain, haven't taken that step. And the Americans could show they're serious by saying, well, we're going to remove our embassy from Jerusalem and make it back in Tel Aviv. And, of course, the only people who could make the Israelis behave themselves, ultimately, without a major catastrophe war, is the Americans. Since the Americans bankroll the US, the Israeli state, I mean, basically, the Israeli middle-class life, which I was talking about earlier, is basically funded by the US taxpayer. And if the US taxpayers decided they didn't want to pay for it anymore, then it wouldn't be such a nice destination to go and live. You might find that lots of people started to leave the country to go and find better life somewhere else, and that might be what the Palestinians would want.
Also, Russia has been voicing concern over increased US and NATO military activity in the Arctic. Russia's foreign minister, the greatest chess player in the world, Sergei Lavrov, he voiced concern over the uptick in US and NATO military activity in the Arctic. Made a speech at a meeting of the Arctic Council in Reykjavik in Iceland. He said, "We are concerned about what's going on close to our borders with Norway. The US has been putting more focus on military cooperation with Norway as part of its strategy to confront Russia in the Arctic. The US has been deploying long-range bombers to Norway for the first time."
Yeah, they've also been deploying long-range bombers with nuclear weapons. The Norwegians thought they had an understanding from... I can't remember the agreement that they had, the name of it, but they had an understanding that nuclear weapons would not be deployed in Norway because that would be considered provocative to the Russians.
Well, Norway...
But the Americans have basically ignored this treaty that they had with Norway, and in fact, when the US ships turned up with nuclear-armed ships and bombers, local people in Tromso have been protesting against this, saying we don't want your nuclear weapons in Norway. But they're being overruled.
Well, apparently, this week, the US Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, has accused Russia of making unlawful claims in the Arctic, something he said the US will respond to. This is obviously what is connected with this Norway business. Next year, Norway will host US and NATO forces for a military exercise to involve 40,000 troops. The head of Norway's military said it's the largest military exercise inside the Arctic Circle since the 1980s.
Yeah, well, the Russians quite rightly feel as if they're being encircled and intimidated. If the Russians and the Chinese were holding military manoeuvres in Canada, the US would get pretty upset, wouldn't they?
Yeah, but I mean, Norway's part of NATO.
Yeah, but Norway may be part of NATO, but Norway has
Canada
an agreement.
Is too, but Russia hasn't got a sort of satellite nation.
The satellite nation for the Russians, if you like, is Finland, which isn't in NATO, and have never been part of NATO and doesn't want to be part of NATO. And basically, they've had a very good relationship.
Actually, Russia itself is quite close to Canada, isn't it?
Yeah.
On Western Canada.
Yeah.
Just a couple of stories before we go to our conspiracy classic. Israeli ultra-nationalists creating a secret online groups to organise violence. Extremists are creating covert virtual groups to organise and spread hate amongst against Arab Israelis, the Sky News can reveal. This whole idea, Israeli ultra-nationalists, what are they?
Well, they've always been there, but because of the rightward drift of Israeli politics over the last few decades, they are now kingmakers in terms of who's going to rule the country. And they've basically come straight out with, you know, we want the Arabs out of Israel. We're going to drive them out. We're going to make it impossible for them. One of the tweets or the WhatsApp message was saying, bring knuckle dusters, petrol, etc. We're going to smash their faces.
The encrypted messaging app Telegram has taken down some channels, including one with what is inverted commas war group in its title and another called Death to Arabs. The current conflict between Israel and Palestine has sparked riots and incidents of street violence between Jewish Israelis and Arab. It sounds to me as if this is a, you know, sort of street fighting tool that you can find out where to get your ammo so you can take the fight to the streets.
Well, that's one of the reasons why the Israelis may have been willing to accept a ceasefire over Gaza, because there are three other fronts opening up. One is in the West Bank, one is in Jerusalem, and the other is within Israel itself, where the two communities are now at daggers drawn, very similar to what happened in Northern Ireland in 1969, where you've got mobs of right-wing Israelis lynching Arab citizens and the police watching on. And at that point, the Arab citizens may decide that they're going to have to defend
themselves.
Well,
this is all linked to social media, because as people do attacks on Arabs, then they're then streamed on the Telegram app or other apps. One Telegram group, whose members call themselves a civilian army, says it grew to 6,000 users before being shut down. The users have regrouped and their channel has apparently now only got 400 users. The users in this group have names like "Every Arab Killed is a Holiday for Us."
Well, if the Israeli state was a genuine protector of human rights, these people would be arrested, but they're not going to be arrested. They're being encouraged.
Finally, a super capitalist depopulation agenda. This is up on the globalresearch.ca site we've been citing for many, many years. Do you want to say something about the guy that runs it, Michel Chossudovsky, Martin? Because he's doing an amazing job with Global Research.
Well, Chossudovsky is originally of Ukrainian origin. And his family emigrated to Canada. He's a political economist, and he used to be one of the big universities he's retired now, in Canada. And he's a bit like the Canadian version of Noam Chomsky, but he's much tougher minded. So, for example, he called out 9/11 as an inside job by the US deep state straight away. No ifs, no buts, they did it. Chomsky has basically butted out of that one.
Okay, so let me just run through some of the points he makes here very quickly about, he's saying here, he wants to, and this is Peter Koenig writing this, Michel Chostovsky is the editor, is the 2010 Rockefeller Report entitled Scenarios for the Future of Technology and International Development, pointed already more than 10 years ago to the lockstep scenario and three more sinister scenarios. And we believe the scenario planning has great potential for the use in philanthropy to identify unique interventions, simulate and rehearse important decisions that could have profound implications, and highlight previously undiscovered areas of connection and intersection. The results of our first scenario planning exercise, a provocative and engaging exploration of the role of technology in the future of globalization. So this is actually looking at depopulation through this 2010 Rockefeller report. But then also another one, the next one down, is Event 201, organised by JHSM, simulated for the coming corona crisis on the 18th of October 2019 in New York City. The main purpose was a computer simulating precisely what began a few months later in Wuhan, China, and is happening today. Then there's also Henry Kissinger's 1974 National Security Study Memorandum 200, stating that population growth must now become a national security threat. The point is still valid more than ever, and its implementation is in full swing, he says. And then Klaus Schwab's World Economic Founder and Chief Executive, the Great Reset, describes in detail what is to happen to humanity in the coming 10 years, also called the UN Agenda 2030, with the infamous concluding quote, "By 2030, you will own nothing and you will be happy." Anyway, there's several more of these, 5, 6, 7, the Georgia Guidestones he even talks about here. But he's trying to hear, Peter Koenig, trying to pull together a lot of different strands of this whole concept that actually depopulation, even though, of course, it's not being talked about in the mass media, may be quietly becoming popular again behind the scenes.
Well, it always was. I mean, you know, wealthy people have always thought there are too many poor people, as I said the other week. The Israeli state wants the oil that's in the Golan Heights, which they occupy illegally, in defiance of international law, but they don't necessarily want the people.
Thanks, Martin. Well, we're going to have a listen now to a clip, 5-minute clip of the infamous Diana interview, and I'm playing this specifically because I think it's a brilliant piece of journalism. Diana was an absolutely fantastic and wonderful person who was utterly betrayed by her husband, Prince Charles, who, by the way, is now trying to rehabilitate himself as some sort of nice guy, and spending a lot of time and effort in getting rid of the idea that this was a good interview. You know, in a way, it's basically trying to say his wife was crazy, you know, paranoid. Well, of course, she wasn't paranoid. She was absolutely right. They were out to get her. The other thing that our sound engineer, Dave Bazanko, pointed out earlier on, whilst we were playing one of our clips, was that there was this film called Unlawful Killing, wasn't there? By Keith Allen, and paid for by the Al-Fayed family, which points out, if anyone could even be bothered to look any further, that this is she did not die in some sort of accident. She was deliberately killed unlawfully. So the idea that that makes her paranoid, I think, is actually a bit of a betrayal by her son William, saying such things about her being paranoid. She clearly wasn't paranoid. Anyway, there's a real massive attempt over the last couple of days, and today particularly, to rewrite history on this. And at the day of the conference of the National Union of Journalists, which it doesn't look like I'm going to be able to get involved with, unfortunately, from Wiltshire branch this year, because of technical trouble, I think it's an absolutely brilliant opportunity to play a clip which talks a lot about the press intervention from that amazing interview from 1995 with Princess Diana by the wonderful, excellent journalist called Martin Bashir.
How would you describe your life now? You do live very much on your own, don't you?
Yes, I am. I don't mind that, actually. You know, people think that at the end of the day, a man is the only answer. Actually, a fulfilling job is better for me.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, any gentleman that's been past my door, we've instantly been put together in the media and all hell's broken loose. So that's been very tough on the male friends I've had, and obviously from my point of view.
Does that mean that you feel that for the rest of your life you'll have to be on your own?
No. I'm not really on my own. I've got wonderful friends, I've got my boys, I've got my work. It's just, by living in Kensington Palace, obviously it is a little bit isolating, but, you know, maybe we all feel like that.
How do you feel about the way the press behaves towards you now?
I still to this day find the interest daunting and phenomenal, because I actually don't like being the centre of attention. When I have my public duties, I understand when I get out of the car I'm being photographed, but actually it's now when I go out of my door, my front door, I'm being photographed. I never know where a lens is going to be. A normal day would be followed by four cars. A normal day would come back to my car and find six freelance photographers jumping around me. Some people would say, well, if you had a policeman, it'd make it easier. It doesn't at all. They've decided that I'm still a project after 15, 16 years that sells well, and they all shout at me, telling me that. Oh, come on, Di, look up. If you give us a picture, I can get my children to a better school. And, you know, you can laugh it off, but you get that the whole time. It's quite difficult.
Some people would say that in the early years of your marriage, you were partly responsible for encouraging the press interest. You mm-hmm. danced with people like Wayne Sleep. You seemed mm-hmm. to enjoy it. Mm-hmm. You had a very good and warm relationship. Do you feel any responsibility for the way the press have behaved towards you?
I never encouraged the media. There was a relationship which worked before, but now I can't tolerate it because it's become abusive. And it's harassment. But I don't want to be seen to indulging in self-pity. I'm not. I understand they have a job to do. You could equate it to a soap opera, really. It goes on and on and on, and the story never changes. And each time one enjoys oneself, albeit it's in a different situation, you have to pay for it because people criticise, which comes with the patch, as I said previously. But I am a free spirit, unfortunately for some.
But here at Kensington Palace, are you isolated?
Well, I am by the nature of my situation, yes. But I don't feel sorry for myself in any way. I've got my work that I choose to do, and I got my boys, and I've got lots of opportunities coming up in the next year, visits abroad. I'm about to go to Argentina, which I'm very happy with, and hope very much to continue the good relationship that's now been adapted between the two countries. I hope I can be of help there.
What role do you see for yourself in the future?
I'd like to be an ambassador for this country. I'd like to represent this country abroad. As I have all this media interest, let's not just sit in this country and be battered by it. Let's take them, these people, out and to represent this country and the good qualities of it abroad. When I go abroad, we've got 60 to 90 photographers just from this country coming with me. So let's use it in a productive way to help this country.
You say you feel that your future is as some form of ambassador.
Mm.
At whose behest is that? On what grounds do you feel that you have the right to think of yourself as an ambassador?
I've been in a privileged position for 15 years, and I've got tremendous knowledge about people and how to communicate. I've learnt that. I've got it, and I want to use it. And when I look at people in public life, I'm not a political animal, but I think the biggest disease this world suffers from in this day and age is the disease of people feeling unloved. And I know that I can give love for a minute, for half an hour, for a day, for a month, but I can give, and I'm very happy to do that, and I want to do that.
Do you think that the British people are happy with you in your role?
I think the British people need someone in public life to give affection, to make them feel important, to support them, to give them light in their dark tunnels. I see it as a possibly unique role, and yes, I've had difficulties, as everybody has witnessed over the years, but let's now use the knowledge I've gathered to help other people in distress.
Do you think you can?
I know I can. I know I can, yeah.
Well, that's Princess Diana in the famous interview, which I think should be de rigueur for all historians, basically, to explain what her situation was back in 1995, having been totally betrayed by the royal family, well, specifically by Prince Charles. And this is a major move, it seems to me, in order to try and discredit her again by the Prince Charles camp. You have to remember, of course, that there's all sorts of potential, I mean, we've just had the death of the Duke of Edinburgh, and when it comes to the royal succession, the Queen is considering the idea of, and she has certainly has been, considering the idea of stepping aside and allowing Prince Charles to become Prince Regent of some sort, so that she is still kind of the boss, but she's allowing him to get on with taking on those duties, which would be very... you know, big change, but we shall see. We shall certainly see. And the Princess of Wales, an amazing interview there. Fantastic journalist Martin Bashir has just been totally bullied, and it's incredible to hear the all the derision poured on him for basically just doing his job. If only there was one person left in the BBC doing a job as well as Martin Bashir, we'd be fine. And all this idea about the bank statements. Somehow managing to get him the interview. Well, he probably shouldn't have done that. It was against the editorial guidelines. But my God, almost everything the BBC do nowadays seems to be totally against their charter and their editorial guidelines. They're biased on almost everything. It just seems to me it's trying to destroy itself in a way. So that, of course, and there's a lot of criticism of the BBC. I do it myself. But just sit and think a minute. You wouldn't have the world tonight. You wouldn't have, you know, the environmental programs. There's some fantastic stuff that they do as well. You wouldn't have the religious broadcasting, you know, and everything would be handed over to the likes of Rupert Murdoch. And Rupert Murdoch is not really anybody except somebody who a banker has given some money to at some point in the past to buy a newspaper or buy a TV station. And so if you didn't have the BBC in this country, we would just have the same as you get in places like Colombia, where private individuals and private networks are all there is. So that's what life would be like in that case. Anyway, I'll put a full version of that up on our show page, that interview with Princess Diana, at thisweek.org.uk. Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guests. And that was Dr. John Rogers and also Ian Robinson from Avonmouth, as well as Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, and sound engineer, thanks to him too, Dave Bazanko. To be included on my weekly email circulation list, please just email me at tony@cultureshop.org.uk, and you'll find that address is on the contact tab on the show page at thisweek.org.uk. If you've got a site or a story you'd like to share, you think there's anything I've missed or have a correction, please do email me with a link or two, or even a scan of what you have, if possible. Do feel free to order for £15 online my book, which is The Traitors of Arnhem, all about the links between Bilderberg conferences right the way back to the Second World War and the Battle of Bridge Too Far, where the same location in the Witch's Cauldron there where the Bilderberg meeting, the first one, took place in 1954, chaired for 20 years by a former SS officer, unbelievably the political wing of NATO and the people really running the show, it seems to me, right now, since we've got 30 or so Bilderbergers in key positions being part of this pandemic, not least of which, of course, are the social media companies, which are shutting down the second opinions given by our lovely doctors. And I've tried to give a few of those this evening too. No doubt if we were to put that up on YouTube, that would probably be immediately gotten rid of. Thank you very much, Eric Schmidt, Bilderberger. Anyway, you'll find not the BCFM Politics Show's podcast, story links, comment page, and our contact details at thisweek.org.uk. And if you want to find the book, by the way, you can just go to bookfinder.com and put Traitors of Arnhem and my name in, and you'll find it. I'm shadow banned on Twitter at Tony Gosling. We've been streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft in Bristol and at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey. What you can do, though, is you can hear the Richie Allen Show from now on here on a Monday to Thursday, and on a Sunday too, restreamed on our programme. This show is repeated at 11 p.m. on Fridays and 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the PRSC stream. And we will be on Sunday lunch, we'll be over at Camberley's RadioQUK.com too. So, here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. We'll be down for the Palestine March tomorrow lunchtime, organised by the Bristol Muslims. Do please join us for the Politics Show live stream at 5 o'clock next Friday. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down. Number one.
by the developing nations alike. Failed you in that we've left you with no vision of a world community and no education to develop such a sense. Consolidated, appealing to the people of Britain. Don't support the fascist war started by the U.S. against a poor third world country just to divert attention away from the war they conduct against their own people every single day. Our politicians and entertainers continue to lie to us repeatedly.
Don't believe the hype.
Well, they certainly don't hedge their bets. I urge you to try and track down their recordings, if you've not already done so, and give them a serious listen. That's Consolidated, the last from them tonight, obviously. America Number One is the title of it.